The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
You're welcome along to OTB AM. Adrian with you as always. We've lost on, but we might touch base with him shortly. But in his stead, Nathan Murphy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you getting on?
Great.
You're a bit of a morning man, I'd say, are you generally?
Oof.
You like to get
no.
up, crack it on?
Well, like many people of my now extreme middle age.
Where's your birthday this week? Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I've had to become a morning person. I was generally a very late night person.
Yeah.
You know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., just sit up doing nothing, wasting my life.
Mm.
Whereas now I'm up bright and early, rowing with my kids to get up and get out for school.
Wasting your life in another way.
Exactly. So I've managed to avoid that this morning.
Right.
So.
Well, that's good. I'm sure your wife is delighted that you're
right
in here with us.
Well, how are you?
We're happy to have you. Good, yeah. Yeah, a couple of restless nights, but... Well, actually, no, one excellent night. I did the thing on Wednesday night where I was putting the kids to bed and woke up like at sort of... the start of that process at whatever time. They went to sleep by 8 o'clock and I woke up the next morning.
Oh, nice.
Great rest.
Nice.
But, I mean, I missed a lot of, obviously, football and...
I missed...
Wasting my evening.
Who cares?
As you would say,
wow.
That's true.
Welcome to this morning's episode of Dadcast.
Yeah, you were elected at the... Was your inaugural?
I don't like to talk about it. Listen,
you're now the chairman of the
Mayo
board.
A Mayo man being the chairman of a board.
What could possibly go wrong?
Generally don't go well.
What do you do? Owen's down there. We've dispatched Owen down to Castlebar to figure out what the hell's going on down there. What are you up to?
Well, listen, I think as we find out for the summer months, as Mayo people, we're just here for the rest of the country's entertainment. And we were a little bit worried... That, you know, everyone was talking about the Dubs and their greatness.
And the World Cup had obviously taken over a little bit. And
bring it back to us. Mm. Give us that little bit of attention that we need, that we crave on a daily basis.
Well, I mean...
And
I
fair play to our county board, yet again, they have stepped up to the mark.
The evidence of the video that I've seen coming from McHale Park last night, they weren't exactly craving the attention.
What did you expect that there'd be a mob outside...
Do you want to give people the context to what's going on here before we...
Well, I presume an awful lot of people understand the context, that there is this ongoing controversy within Mayo GEA that's been brewing for probably 2-3 months at this stage, going on behind the scenes a little bit longer, but certainly in the public sphere it's been going on, relating to the Mayo International Supporters Foundation, which is headed up by a very rich English businessman, Tim O'Leary, who is a Mayo heritage, who... are there essentially to raise funds from other very rich diaspora to put back into Mayo GEA. Mm. Primarily, it seems, at inter-county level to provide the inter-county team with everything they need because obviously it's a very expensive business these days. But there's been a major breakdown in trust and communication which has led to Tim O'Leary withholding €250,000 of money that was raised at a dinner in New York when Mayo were over there.
Withholding, I presume.
The foundation withholding this. And now, a lot of the foundation money is a personal donation from Tim O'Leary because there was €150,000 donated previously by the foundation that they were told they would receive receipts for, and they're unhappy with the level of detail.
They have concerns about the governance, they have concerns about sponsorship, they have concerns about the money was raised in relation to a number of specific projects.
All of these things. So it started, I think, very straightforward with the 150 grand and the explanation about where that was spent. And it's delved deeper into, is best practice been applied throughout all aspects of Mayo GEA and the county board, as you say, regarding the sponsorship of McHale Park, regarding the amount of money that they're raising through sponsorship of the jerseys, of everything, as are they going out and bringing in as much money as is possible? And it's got pretty bitter, I think it's fair to say, and it's got pretty petty as well. There have been some bad mistakes. There's been a constant supply of emails and leaks and stories coming from both sides, and unfortunately for the Mayo County Board at times, when they have replied to Tim O'Leary and his questions, they've made that terrible error, that awful moment when you're sitting in the office and you realise you've forwarded on the email and not deleted all the previous emails. So one of those incidents resulted in Tim O'Leary being called a donkey, which it feels has escalated this even more. Mm. Then at the recent county final, or at the underdogs match that they played against Mayo, Shoe the Donkey was played, which again has just riled things up even further. All of this, I think, was still very much a, even though it had been in the national newspapers, it was sort of rumbling along and people weren't quite sure, and I think they saw it as a bit of a sideshow and weren't overly bothered. What really seems to have happened is that the Mayo County Board decided this week that they didn't want to answer any questions and they didn't want the media there at their county board meetings anymore to see that they didn't want to answer any questions. So they proposed essentially banning the media from the county board meetings. And it seems that, I certainly know from personal experience, that having got bits and pieces and, you know, Mayo supporters get in touch on what's going on here, the amount of correspondence I've had in the last 3 or 4 days since the county board decided to ban the media has been insane. Mm. The anger levels of, actually, there's clearly something going on there that they don't want to answer questions.
Yeah. Now, I have to say that I'm glad to hear that, because the idea, and this happens quite frequently, I've certainly seen it crop up over the last 4 or 5 years, and I would attribute it to the Donald Trump-style fake news introduction. Like, the post that the amount of organisations, and I would include my OGA in that now, who have used that hashtag fake news moniker as a way to ultimately shed them away from any notion of transparency. So they'll use it to say that we have to get about our business internally, the media don't deserve to be in there, and we have to have those discussions away from the public glare. That is the biggest two fingers that they could possibly put up to Mayo GAA fans. It's nothing to do with the media or this fake news thing. And Owen was down there last night and he was trying to get comment last night. He obviously wasn't allowed, permitted into the meeting. I don't mind that if on occasion they would say, listen, this is a highly sensitive topic. There's some threat of legal action here. For this instance, we're going to have to do that behind closed doors, because we need, particularly in relation to the extraordinary aspect of the meetings that they've had over the last while, I think that would be perfectly acceptable if they were trying to balance themselves away from ultimately getting sued by any party. So I would understand that. But actually, they're using this as an opportunity to say the media are no longer welcome to these meetings. And they're also coming up with this stuff that, well, this is what happens. It happens at most of the counties in the country. That's actually not the case. I have to say, it's a slap in the face for Mayo GAA fans.
This isn't a private business. This is not a private business. The Mayo County Board is not a private business. They have to answer to the public. They are essentially the custodians of Mayo GAA there. And this is something they will try and fall back on, is they are the representative of the Mayo GAA public, because they are voted in by the delegates, who are the representatives of the clubs, who are elected by the members of the clubs. So therefore, it all goes back to grassroots. And there's obviously a greater debate constantly about, well, who are the delegates? Do people take enough interest in who their club delegates are? But it does feel as though the Mayo County Board think they can just bunker down, maintain their cosy little club where they don't have to answer any questions to anybody, that they're very much beyond reproach with all of this, where I think the delegates clearly haven't been asking the right questions, and Mayo, in fairness, has been very well served by the media. Like, the level of media coverage around the inter-county team is exceptional. There's three daily newspapers, there's a local radio station who provide an insane amount of coverage. And like what the Mayo News do, I would say the Mayo News is, in terms of GAA coverage, the best in the country. And they have some brilliant journalists down there who should be in there and asking these questions. And the thing, much like with the FAI, is when it comes to the financial side of things, journalists, unfortunately, have to believe what they're told in a way, because you don't get the minutiae of the finances. All you get is very much the top line figures, which are generally, you're told, audited and presented to you. So it's only when an issue like this that somebody on the inside says, well, actually, all is not what it seems here, that suddenly you can pounce on this and go, well, actually, answer the questions now. Explain this fully. But they don't want to explain it. And it is getting quite confusing now, because one of the reasons that, so we've had two big issues this week, I guess. One was, that's escalated as well, on the county board meeting, where it seems that the Mayo County Board came out and said that they had a resounding vote of confidence in the board. That turned out there was no vote of confidence whatsoever. And that was only exposed by people in the room afterwards going back to their clubs and saying, no, no, somebody proposed a vote of confidence. It was seconded. And that was it. Mm. Then they all moved on and went, great. Everyone's delighted what we're doing. But also, Colin McKee says the story, and I presume a lot of this from Colin McKee's was in advance of the meeting last night, in terms of what was happening with the foundation. So they said at the meeting on Monday night that they couldn't talk about the legal action regarding the foundation, because they had received a letter from London-based legal representatives from the foundation chairman, Tim O'Leary, warning of any potential defamatory comments made about him. That prompted legal advice that specific detail related to the dispute should not be discussed. So the Mayo County Board went and said, well, listen, we've received a legal letter. We're not going to talk about this.
Yeah.
We're not going to answer any questions. We can't. And that may well be the right and proper thing to do. That may well have been their legal advice. However, the foundation have come out and said that actually they had no issue with the foundation being discussed. They didn't want to shut that down. It was just personal to Tim O'Leary.
Mm. Into this, his love for Mayo GAA knows no bounds, it turns out. Owen Sheehan, he's the reason that he's not here, was made an executive decision over the last 24 hours that he should wing his way to Castlebar for that emergency Mayo GAA County Board meeting that the media, of course, were banned from. So surely he gets something down there.
You're welcome along to Elvery's McHale Park here in Castlebar, where Mayo GAA have called an emergency county board meeting. Now, media are not permitted to attend that meeting, so you might be asking yourself the question, why am I here? Well, to be honest with you, I'm asking myself the same question.
So the emergency meeting is taking place behind those doors at the moment. Rumour has it that there is a shoot on site policy for any journalist that enters the room. You may have thought Ross Kemp in Afghanistan was something, but this is way bigger. Going into that room right now for me would be like living in the German Democratic Republic 35 years ago and trying to hop the Berlin Wall.
A rather startling discovery here in McHale Park. As you can see, a lot of sand here on the back of this tractor. Where do you think this sand came from? That's right. It came from the graves they've already dug for the journalists at the back, those journalists that they find upstairs. So that right there behind me is where the meeting is taking place. You can see a little bit of light peeking through the curtains. But if you're a journalist who walks into that room, light will never peek into your life ever again. So we're here at the shop, and it turns out that controversially, Elvery's McHale Park only stocks yellow snacks. Where are the pink snacks at? Clearly the best snack. Also controversially, the shop is closed on what is one of the biggest nights in Mayo GAA's year. Couldn't catch me out though. Bring your own food ahead of the game. And I knew it would be an extra long meeting, so I've gone for a Twix Extra. Absolute 10 out of 10 chocolate bar.
To be fair, he was bored. He was there for a couple of hours. There wasn't much going on. But I mean, he got to the bottom of the story there. When things actually happened a little bit later on, which was that the county board executive started to leave the room, the chairman, Mr. Kennelly, was among those who left, and Owen tried to grab a word with him.
Folks, I just grab a question since media weren't allowed in tonight, just on what happened at the meeting.
Paul will be issued a statement. You know what I mean?
What's your own opinion on media not being allowed into county board meetings?
No, Paul, as I said, will be issuing a statement, and that's the way it'll be.
You think it's fair that the people in Mayo don't know what's going on?
I mean, you have to look at other counties, what's happening.
Do you think that other counties are right to do so? Will it be revisited?
It's quite possible. Delegates will decide that.
And in the vote of no confidence today, was that brought the vote of confidence today? Was that brought up again?
Well, as they should have said, in the story.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was on in conversation briefly with the Mayo County Board Chairman Mike Kennelly after the meeting last night. We'll have lots more on this over the course of the morning. Here's a bit of a flavour of what's happening on OTBAM on this cold Friday morning. You're very welcome along to the show. We're going to get stuck into the back pages in just a couple of moments' time, let you know what's happening on the newspapers this morning. We're going to chat about the pretty interesting weekend of Premier League. I mean, it's mainly focused on the action at Anfield on Sunday afternoon. Obviously, Liverpool up against Manchester City. We're going to get stuck into that debate in the company of Phil Thompson. A bit of a Friday OTBAM regular at this stage, so we'll get his thoughts on how exactly he thinks that game is going to go. Owen is going to join us on the line from Mayo a little bit later in the show, where he's going to detail exactly what it was that went down last night, or the lack of it, and where the very latest state of play is between Mayo GAA and that fundraising foundation. So Owen is going to bring us all of that. We're going to have the latest sports news as well. Alan Quinlan, as you've been hearing during the week on OTBAM, back from Japan, and is going to take us through some of the latest developments in the world of rugby, including the fallout from the Saracens points deduction, and obviously the Pro 14. Pretty interesting weekend of Pro 14 rugby as well. So that's all coming your way just after 9 o'clock this morning. We'll bring you the live sports news as well. So that's OTBAM on this Friday morning. It's time for the papers. OTBAM. Going to kick things off for you with the Irish Daily Star this morning. I'm going to draw your attention to this little line over here from Jacob Patterson, who says that Martin is in the frame to get the North job. This was a bit of a surprise, I have to say, when I picked up the papers this morning to see that it looks now at Michael O'Neill is almost certainly going to take that Stoke job. I think he's going to see out the last couple of qualifiers with the North before doubling his wage to take on that Stoke City gig. And Martin O'Neill writes Jacob Patterson. Here's a bit of a flavour of what's happening on OTB AM on this cold Friday morning. You're very welcome along to the show. We're going to get stuck into the back pages in just a couple of moments' time, let you know what's happening on the newspapers this morning. We're going to chat about the pretty interesting weekend of Premier League. I mean, it's mainly focused on the action at Anfield on Sunday afternoon. Obviously, Liverpool up against Manchester City. We're going to get stuck into that debate in the company of Phil Thompson, a bit of a Friday OTB AM regular at this stage, so we'll get his thoughts on how exactly he thinks that game is going to go. Owen is going to join us on the line from Mayo a little bit later in the show, where he's going to detail exactly what it was that went down last night, or the lack of it, and where the very latest state of play is between Mayo GA and that fundraising foundation. So Owen is going to bring us all of that. We're going to have the latest sports news as well. Alan Quinlan, as you've been hearing during the weekend, ought to be back from Japan and is going to take us through some of the latest developments in the world of rugby, including the fallout from the Saracens points deduction and obviously the Pro 14. Pretty interesting weekend of Pro 14 rugby as well. So that's all coming your way just after 9 o'clock this morning. We'll bring you the live sports news as well. So that's OTB AM on this Friday morning. It's time for the papers. OTB AM. Going to kick things off for you with the Irish Daily Star this morning. I'm going to draw your attention to this little line over here from Jacob Patterson, who says that Martin is in the frame to get the North job. This was a bit of a surprise, I have to say, when I picked up the papers this morning to see that it looks now at Michael O'Neill is almost certainly going to take that Stoke job. I think he's going to see out the last couple of qualifiers with the North before doubling his wage to take on that Stoke City gig. And Martin O'Neill, writes Jacob Patterson, is in the frame to replace him at Northern Ireland. And this, I think, will be a bit of a surprise to Why? Irish football fans. I think because I saw somebody making the point yesterday that it's surprising to have seen a club like Stoke, who were in the market for Martin O'Neill previously, and you would say they're very different managers. It appears from the outside looking in, they're very different managers about how they go about their business. And so if that's slightly askew, then you would think it's slightly askew that the job that he's leaving, that same people would be interested in Martin O'Neill getting the gig.
I think, again, we're underestimating Martin O'Neill's reputation outside of the Republic of Ireland. The reason Stoke went after him a year ago is because his reputation in England is still very high. And in fact, I would argue his reputation in England is higher than that of Michael O'Neill, despite all that Michael O'Neill has done with Northern Ireland. Michael O'Neill needs to prove himself at championship level. I think he will. I think Stoke's a perfect fit for Michael O'Neill in many ways. But where did Northern Ireland go? Like, what are their options? Martin O'Neill, former player.
Ian Barraclough, Tommy Wright, Stephen Robinson, all the
exactly
big names that you'd...
So if they can get Martin O'Neill at the right price, I think they're going to go after that. It's obviously going to be a huge shock to the system, and there is the possibility that we may end up playing Northern Ireland in the Nations League playoffs next March.
And they beat us 4-5-0 under the tutelage of Martin
O'Neill. Free-flowing Martin O'Neill naming his team 4 days in advance.
Yeah. Where did it all go wrong and where do we go from here? That's really what you're asking. Elsewhere on the back page this morning is Roman Gods, Lennon's Wonder Boys stun Lazio. This is Celtic's late winner at Lazio last night, 2-1. And it's not winner bus, says Jurgen Klopp, ahead of the big game against Manchester City this week, this weekend. And a photograph of the famous bus scenes from one of last year's fixtures between the two. Not winner bust.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say it's not winner bust. It's about a quarter of the way through the season.
It's classic. It's a massive game, so we tried to downplay it, as opposed to it's a shit game, and so we need to overstate it. It's pretty classic manager speak.
The Liverpool City game's on the back of a lot of the pages, and it's all actually around the bus, because City demanding guarantees of safety ahead of Anfield trip. It was actually the Champions League game the season before last where all the issues were, and there was the famous footage from inside when the Liverpool supporters, as they did a lot during that season and have done since, surround the bus, create the atmosphere, set off the flares, but it got completely out of hand. Bus was attacked. Very fortunate that there weren't more serious injuries. So Manchester City, this is the back page of the Irish Independent, they've sought assurances from Liverpool about security arrangement for Sunday's top-of-the-table clash, talking about the bottles and flares that were thrown and Pep Guardiola complaining about the lack of protection. And City were bemused afterwards that there were no arrests made. Last season's game, and interestingly, they played this time last season and it was the dullest game of the year. nil-nil draw, and there was nothing on the pitch or off the pitch. But there have been posters circulating on social media, Adrian, urging fans to line the streets around Anfield to bring pyro, pints, flags and banners to make the atmosphere like a European night. City expected to keep their route to Anfield a secret in an attempt to ensure they arrive unscathed. But eventually you have to get to Anfield and right around the stadium, and there's four ways in.
So there's so many laundry baskets that you
can... And there's only one entrance where the bus can go. Yeah. So I think the Liverpool supporters are going to be there. As long as nobody does something stupid, all of this is perfectly fine. Being on the streets, having your flares, all of that. But as you say, all it takes is one lunatic, and not even a lunatic, one just idiot with a few pints on him, with a pint glass in his hand, who throws it at the bus, and all hell breaks loose. So you would hope that actually Liverpool supporters, I'm sure, want to make this a thing that they can do for every game and have that sort of atmosphere. But if it goes wrong once, that's probably going to be the end of it. Maybe City just bringing this up again to distract from some of their own problems. The other story, by the way, on the back of the Independent, house hunting McIlroy may play in more European Tour tournaments. Now, it's very unlike Rory McIlroy to change his mind on something, clearly. But Rory McIlroy, it seems, is making preparations to spend more time in England after previously basing himself in the United States, according to Global Golf Post, that most reputable of sources.
It's up there at Golf Weekly.
McIlroy is planning to buy a property in London or Wentworth to use as a base between May and October. The news surprising, considering the conviction which McIlroy has spoken about preferring life on the other side of the Atlantic.
It's gas. That's all I can say about it. The Examiner this morning, it's Nitcham's injury time winner that sent Celtic into the knockout rounds of the Europa League and that celebration last night. And also Duncan Casey's column today. Inside focuses on the Munster influence at South Africa for the World Cup, particularly the S&C coach Alec Walters. And one good story here that I'll try and recount for you as briefly as I possibly can. But both of them worked at Munster, and Duncan Casey was saying, which was a bit of a surprise to me, how the S&C coach at times can be the one who delivers the news from the head coaching team that would be sort of stepping in terms of, even in relation to form and stuff like that, they're taking players aside and saying, where are you at from an injury point of view, and having those types of conversations with them, which I hadn't fully appreciated. But he says that Alan Walters is somebody who you'd literally kick a door down for.
Right.
They had a couple of these recovery boots, you know, the recovery boots that players have, but they only had two pairs of them at Munster. Sometimes players would take them home and then they would never come back again. So Alan Walters was pretty protective of his recovery boots. Duncan Casey said at one point, oh, I have an early appointment, can I take them? I'll bring them in the next morning. Did that, left his house, forgot them, thought, I can't go back in without the boots because I don't want to let this guy down. But I ran back into he was staying in student accommodation, his key fob wouldn't work. He's like, oh, right, I'm kicking the door down because the office won't be open till 9 o'clock to get the card to work. Kicks the door down, as he says, wood sort of splats everywhere, the doors and smithereens, he goes flying in. He's like, he's normally got like a wooden bookshelf just inside the door. He's like, he rushes in.
I see where this
he's
is
like,
going.
Where's the bookcase? And he sees all these women's underwear everywhere. And he's like, ah, oh, shit, this is not my house. He's kicked down the wrong door.
Why was there women's underwear everywhere?
Because it was the wrong, it was, there was like a, there was obviously a laundry horse. What's it called? Okay. Clothes
all horse. Right. Horse. I was going to say, a lingerie party.
a laundry horse. It's new. I just invented something new. Anyway.
A laundry or a lingerie? Which one is it, Adrian?
To be fair, he says women's laundry is all he says, and a clothes horse in front of me, at which point it dawned on me I was in the wrong apartment. I don't know what that says about anything. But there we go. Good story.
The Irish Times, story from Gavin Comiskey, which I think there's been a lot of rumours about this down in Connacht over the last little while. Doubts over Aki and Marmion's Connacht future. We can chat about this with Alan Quinlan when he's in. But Connacht facing an injury crisis and the long-term possibility of life without two of their Ireland internationals, Kieran Marmion and Bundy Aki. They're without the likes of Gavin Turnbury and Quinn Rue for their Champions Cup openers. Saracens, it seems, looking to add Kieran Marmion to their squad ahead of next season. Obviously, Saracens have some other issues at the moment, but it seems a number of English Premiership clubs would sign 27-year-old Kieran Marmion. Andy Friend was talking at the Champions Cup launch on Wednesday, said they're very keen for Marmion to stay. It does seem, reading through this, that Marmion has not taken the omission from the World Cup squad very well, which is totally understandable, and that he's extremely frustrated with not making it and is very much considering his future in Ireland. And likewise with Bundy Aki, who obviously wasn't happy when he signed his new contract, and then Pat Lam jumped ship very soon afterwards. There was a lot of talk at the time in 2016 he might sign for Munster. It seems with Munster on the verge of signing Damien Deland that they're going to be well stocked in the centre, so too are Leinster. And if Aki is going to leave, that it's probably going to be abroad, which would bring, like Marmion, an end to his international career. And obviously losing the two of them would be a monster blow for Connacht, particularly. Even these sort of stories, when they've made such a good, strong start to the season, to have this sort of stuff swirling around.
Hard to know if they, because they do crop up every now and then, and it's hard to know whether to get sucked in by them, that actually there might be something real about them.
Well, all these stories
just
are
a bit of gamesmanship.
And at 1 o'clock today, we get an email in to say that Buddy Aki signed a new 3-year contract.
Added a nice bit of turf onto their pay packet, whatever else. We're going to talk to that, regardless of whether it's just smoke and mirrors. We're going to talk to Al Quinlan about it later on.
As if it's very much true.
Saracens have damaged lives of rivals, says Danny Kerr. This is the London Times today. He talks about the various punishments that the English club have been hit with on the back of their breaching the pay cap. He says it affects people's lives, it affects people's families, and that's why so many players have been so annoyed over the years that it's been swept under the carpet, that it's been brushed aside. So it's the human impact of the breach of those pay caps at Saracens. Southgate rap for Maddison. This is James Maddison been told that he must become a high-performance, low-maintenance player if he's going to thrive under Gareth Southgate. And FA to consider spying charges. Liverpool, it turns out, writes Martin Ziegler and Matt Dickinson, have been their sporting director, Michael Edwards, and a couple of other staff members are possibly facing individual misconduct charges from the FA over allegations that they hacked into Manchester City's scouting network.
Yeah, this has been doing the rounds for the last couple of months as to whether or not actually there's going to be an investigation. It seems that a staff member left one club, went to the other, and brought some good stuff with them. And that Liverpool, you'd wonder what the level of punishment can be for something like that.
Well,
it's, what is spying?
Yeah,
in football.
I don't know.
Unless you've illegally hacked into something.
Frequently, what's spying? Employment contracts is written in some sort of a, our information is not your information, and when you leave that shit behind you. But in reality,
you have some sort of Men in Black style thing where you forget everything you've previously learned.
I mean, in reality, I think that's just accepted.
The Guardian, front page of The Guardian, actually, policeman charged over death of footballer. I think we're going to hear a lot more about this over the coming days. Police constable yesterday charged with the murder of former footballer Dalian Atkinson following the fatal encounter in which a stun gun and other force was used. Atkinson, of course, who played for Aston Villa, Manchester City, he died in 2016 at the age of just 48 after a row outside his father's home in Telford. Two officers are going to be prosecuted over his murder. And in the sports section, again, fears of repeat bus attack. City asked Liverpool to ensure safety after fans call for flares. I would have assumed that, and maybe I'm wrong in how policing works around these games, that actually you're talking to Merseyside police to ensure their safety rather than Liverpool as a club.
Yeah.
All Liverpool as a club can do is say, please don't attack
the
bus.
I presume there's three-way conversations there. I presume that all parties are having sort of parallel conversations. Macht absent, writes the Irish Daily Mail this morning. This is McCarthy turns down Mick's Ireland call-up, writes Philip Quinn here. It's been McCarthy rocked by James, Mick McCarthy rocked by James McCarthy's decision to reject a return to the Republic of Ireland fall this month. The reasons are a little bit unclear, it has to be said. The personal reasons, I think, is what's been given.
Yeah. I mentioned the Dan McDonald on the football show last night. Like, personal reasons is a very loaded statement. So Stephen Doyle spoke to James McCarthy
in one of the great interviews of all time.
Great questioning.
It was the inventiveness to reword that question five times over.
And the brilliance of James McCarthy to still somehow go back and give the same answer again
and again.
You might
say brilliance.
That's James McCarthy, and I'm not surprised that that's the sort of interview he gave. But I think now looking at that, it's no surprise that James McCarthy's not in the squad. You definitely got the sense that the best thing for him, and it probably is the best thing for him after such a long layoff, and he's played little or no football in over 3 years, that is to stay at Crystal Palace, get his fitness up and up and up, and actually put himself in a position that after the international break, Roy Hodgson is saying, you know what, you're back in the team, and he gets a run of games. Personal issues suggests there's something else going on, that he doesn't want to be part of this squad. Whereas actually, if it's just fitness, just say,
yeah,
he's hanging back. Yeah. Maybe there is something
probably
else going on.
There's probably more to it if that's what's happening. It's just taking each game as it comes, week after week, as he says.
Finally, the Mirror busted again. City called for action to prevent new cop coach attack after pyros and pints. Social media post. Also, Andre Gomez could make a rapid return from his ankle break. They saying he could actually play again this season. And Gunners want Xhaka out in January. John Cross with the exclusive that Arsenal are going to try and get rid of Granit Xhaka.
Christ, what
an overreaction.
Shambles. Now, the Irish news before we leave the newspapers for you this morning. O'Neill poised for Stoke move. This is the story that rumbles on. It looks like it's going to happen at some point in the next few days. And Schlock Neil Boss happy with the underdog tag. That is the newspapers for you this morning. It's almost 8 o'clock on this Friday morning. It's cold and it's frosty. And we'd love to hear from you this morning to get your thoughts on whether it's the Premier League or the rugby, whatever it is that's floating your boat. My OGAA, as we've been discussing a bit earlier, and we will be discussing again a little later on, whatever it is that floats your boat this morning ahead of the weekend, please do get in contact with us. You're watching or listening to OTBAM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. As I said, it is 8 o'clock on this Friday morning. We're going to be back in just a couple of moments' time. We're going to talk Liverpool against Manchester City in the company of Richard Dunn and Phil Thompson. OTB
AM. I'd say he'd be worried about them anyway, Nathan. But it's unlike him to make a statement like that. It's not his style to do that. And I was surprised at him making the statement. I'd say he'd be concerned about it. I think Liverpool are in better form than Manchester City. Watched Manchester City last night. I know it was the Champions League. It wasn't against Liverpool. But they weren't impressive. Not only they're playing well, the goalkeeper got injured. He might be fit for the weekend. The defenders that we know have been injured. I think Liverpool are playing better than City at the moment. I'd be, you know, if I was a Manchester City manager now, I think I'd be a bit concerned about the weekend match.
Yeah, it'll be understandable then if there is a bit of stress kicking in for Guardiola, because they're going to this match. Yeah, 6 points behind. All right, it's still very early in the season, but 6 points behind and a lot of injuries
is,
starting to rack up.
It is, but he normally doesn't show. You know, I think his behaviour has been excellent wherever he's been, you know, in Barcelona. I think he's hardly put a foot wrong. He made a couple of statements at the weekend, which would be true, but I don't think he was right to say them, because his own players do the same thing. All the players do it now, Nathan, you know. And there's no doubt, I've seen Sané dive a few times. But I've seen Aguero dive. I've seen some of the Manchester City players. There's no manager can really complain, in my opinion, in the Premiership about the opposition diving.
John Giles, in conversation with Nathan on Off the Ball last night, Nathan Murphy FM. Good morning to you.
Where are you on diving?
I do. I've kind of come around to that point that actually it's probably now a necessary part of the game. Like, I remember at a time, late 90s, where it had started to come into the game, where the movement of foreign players into the Premiership at the time was beginning to reach that level that we're now seeing it sort of manifest itself. But at the time, it was outrageous. It was like, all these Italians coming in here. Jurgen Klinsmann was like such a villain of the piece for doing what he did. Whereas now, you just look at that stuff and you go, well, it's legitimate gamesmanship.
But also, and I mentioned this to John last night, has the game actually just changed in that players now are so fast that it doesn't take as much to bring them to ground? Everything happens so much quicker than it previously did. Like, I never really thought it was cheating, because it's not premeditated. You haven't sat down before the game and thought, if the defender comes near me, I'm just going to throw myself.
I'm sure that some players do. Like, that's the reality of it, that each, to borrow the man's phrase himself, you take each instance on its own merits, right? Like that, because there will be players, like, that's the thing. There are a whole range of players out there who will dive for diving sake, who will say to themselves, if I get any slight bit of a nudge of contact, particularly in the area, I'm going down. Like, and you do see that happen.
Well, and it'd be interesting to get the players' take on this, and when Richard Dunn comes on, in terms of, well, as a centre half, it probably used to drive him mad. But you should go to ground, because you're not going to get the decision otherwise. But like, when was the last time you saw a penalty kick awarded for a tackle on a player who stayed in his feet?
But you're then, that's assuming that every challenge is the same challenge. But like, the reality is that sometimes there'll be players who are barely touched, who could very easily have stayed on their feet, that it's never a penalty, and they will go down. And sometimes the referee will spot that and they'll call it out. And sometimes there's enough contact to marginally throw that player off their stride and potentially rule out a potential goal-scoring chance, and they will go to ground. But I think that's legitimate.
But trying to make that difference is nigh on impossible. Yeah. Like, it is, because as you say, and again, part of the problem is we slow it down so much that if Sadio Mane, say, who's in the spotlight, and like, I think the irony of Guardiola focusing on Mane was that I would say Mane and Raheem Sterling are so similar in the way that they're fouled. Mm. Like, they're both brilliant at doing that thing that Mane's done quite a bit over the last few weeks of stepping across in front of the defender and forcing him to kick from behind, taking the contact. But also, both of them run at such speed that the slightest little nick on their foot, I would say, is going to send them to ground.
The other thing that I think is that players now, the cost of injury now is so much more than it was before. And I do think that that's in players' mindsets before games. I think that they're thinking, if there's any chance that that sliding tackle coming across is going to have any adverse effect on me, I'm getting off my feet ASAP, because the cost of being out for 2 or 3 or 6 months is just too much.
Maybe this thing does work, though, because there was similar talk about Mo Salah about a year ago, about him diving.
Yeah.
And I've seen countless times in the last few months where Mo Salah has probably had similar contact to Sadio Mane, and Salah stayed in his feet. He's forced himself inside the area to stay in his feet, and he doesn't get the decision then. Mm. Don't get the penalty, because he's probably aware of the criticism that's been there. Like, there is actually, again, a strange irony to this in that Liverpool don't get many penalty kicks at Anfield. You would expect that on home soil with that crowd, they would get a lot. But I think there's such a probably awareness of referees that everyone expects that Liverpool to get penalty kicks at Anfield that they actually get less than you would expect.
Yeah.
Sadio Mane is going to be fouled for a penalty this weekend.
Yeah, but it worked the other way the last time, didn't it? It was a late City penalty that
Riyad Mahrez missed.
Mahrez skied, yeah. Mm. Right, we're going to get stuck into that in just a few minutes. We haven't even mentioned like the big boxing for the weekend. Logan Paul and CSI Miami or whatever he's called.
I have no idea
what KSI. This is about. You know, there's two YouTubers. Paul Rouse is writing about it. He says his professional boxing sold its soul forever in the Examiner this morning.
Why? How have rematch, they sold their soul?
I haven't read the piece, so to be fair, I don't want to be doing the man an injustice, but like, I think this is more, now bear with me on this one, YouTube selling its soul rather than professional boxing.
So KSI is a very popular YouTuber,
they're
I've heard.
Two YouTubers.
But is Logan Paul not some sort of right-wing lunatic?
You're looking for a response there. I've absolutely no idea. Tommy's going to give us all the...
Tom alone is going to fill us in.
Yeah,
okay.
I said Tommy.
Tommy?
Yeah. Somebody who's got a younger age profile than us. That's what's going to happen there. Right. 7 minutes past eight this Friday morning. We're going to talk football with Phil Thompson and Richard Dunn right now. Just before that, here's Kenny Cunningham and Fabinho from earlier in the week. Liverpool fans are not happy with
him. The biggest question for me, though, and I know obviously Liverpool supporters might be shouting and screaming at me, is Fabinho's position in that holding midfield position. I'm not totally convinced. He's a very good player, don't get me wrong. We're not arguing here, is he a good or a bad player? He's a very good player, very talented, very good all-rounded player, very good at possession, distribution's very good. But as a purely defensive midfield player, going into this game there against Manchester City, that holding midfield player now needs a very specific skill set to cope with the problems that kind of Silva and De Bruyne are going to give you in those inside channels. You've really got to be switched on defensively. You've got to sense danger. You've got to slide across the pitch, make tackles, track runners, you know, just sense danger every 5-10 seconds. And for me, that's not the strongest part of Fabinho's game. And if you actually look at this, some of the significant number of goals that Liverpool have conceded this season, it's down to kind of Fabinho's kind of just lack of alertness, not kind of sensing danger, and at times not having the leg power, lads, to get across the pitch and snuff out danger. If you think back to the Chelsea, Kante goal against Chelsea, Kante just waltzed by him in centre midfield, just couldn't run, couldn't move his legs. I'm thinking to the Leicester goal at Anfield a couple of weeks ago. Perez, I think it was, just got in behind him, ball played in behind him, got toward, played in Madison for the goal, didn't see the danger. Even the Arsenal game, the Tottenham game, last week when Tottenham broke early in the game, Fabinho was the man who missed the first tackle in central midfield when they broke and won back possession. It was a lazy tackle, and then his recovery wasn't quick enough. So small things like that matter in games like this, particularly against Manchester City.
Yeah, Kenny Cunningham there at his thoughts on Fabinho during the week. Phil Thompson, good morning to you.
Good morning. Sorry, I'm just laughing so much. Oh my goodness! I didn't get it. You said Kenny Cunningham. Did you finish it? Barcelona coach, Real Madrid coach. He obviously has picked out a couple of incidents there, and I do take it he's probably done a little bit of homework, but. This is a guy, Fabinho, who's probably been rated the best holding midfield player in the country. Kante, who we've always reckoned was one, his position has changed. Fabinho has been absolutely outstanding. And those couple of incidents, yes, I think I can remember them, and they might have got in there. But this guy is, you look at what he can do, sliding across, doing things. He does all these things, and he's got the longest legs in the world and making tackles across in that area. I think Kenny is just looking for a little bit of wind-up, I think, of Liverpool fans. Certainly he's got me wound up.
Like to take out the essence of what he's saying, Phil, right, his points about that, his criticism of Fabinho, and it shouldn't be lost that he has resoundingly said he's a quality player, and it's his opinion, that he doesn't sense danger enough, not the strongest part of his game, that he lacks alertness and the leg power. They're the specific criticisms, which you're saying you don't see. Is that right?
No, I don't see, because I've probably seen a lot more of him than Kenny has. And I see this, his alertness, his quickness off the over the ground. He's I'm not saying he's electric. I'm not saying he's in Kante's sort of pace, but he's very, very good. And that's what I'm saying. And with these long legs, these telescopic legs that he has, the number of challenges that I see him make, I think he makes more saving tackles in front of the back four than he does people getting past him. And, you know, I would like to think the defensive line, and I'm a central defender, sometimes I feel like the boys are playing maybe 5 yards further up this season. It's not just that. It's the reaction when the ball goes over the top and the ball goes past them. I think that is a lot to blame for the reaction time of the defenders rather than what Fabinho is doing in front. I think Fabinho has been one of our best players this season, and a player that we can't do without. Never mind, has got to sort of up his game for Manchester City.
Phil, is Kenny not making a fair point, though, that when you talk about Fabinho there, and defensively, I'm not sure you can put him alongside N'Golo Kante in terms of how he can stop play. But you touched on Liverpool's change in style and playing a higher line. That actually Fabinho is a very different player for Liverpool this season, even though he plays in that deepest role of the three midfielders, in the holding role. It almost feels like he is he's the first attacker almost. Like, he's the one who starts everything off. I was saying earlier in the week, it's like Liverpool play this sort of pinball machine, and he's the one who's pressing the button, because the ball comes back, he fires it out to Alexander-Arnold or to Robertson, it's fired into the area, the ball comes out, Fabinho again picks it up. That actually, he gets a lot more on the ball now, and his main job is to start attacks rather than prevent attacks from the other side.
Guys, this is the thing which I think is an all-round player. He's improved dramatically. Is that he is caught, you know, when we talk about Van Dijk, we talk about Mane, Firmino and Salah. Maybe Salah not as much this year as the go-to men. This guy's become an important cog in this machine. And you're quite right. He's a very good footballer. Besides a defensive player where I believe he can make the tackles, and he's certainly very good. He's exceptional in the air as well, which is an added bonus, which Kante doesn't have. But you're quite right there. He's the one where they start off. Sometimes the centre-backs will split. He'll drop into that, making it like a third centre-back, which is able to push Alexander-Arnold further forward and Robertson. And you're quite right, if it's not Van Dijk who's making those diagonal balls, it'll be Fabinho who does it. So there's a lot more to this fella's game, which has progressed. So I think I've got it right, is that Gary Neville was comparing him a few weeks ago. He said he's one of the most improved players and the best central midfield player in the country. I think I've got that right.
Yeah, I can easily see it, by the
and
way.
I think Gary Neville's done a little bit more than Kenny, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I can easily see how those points sit alongside each other as well, by the way. But I'm sure it's a debate that we'll maybe know a little bit more about post-Sunday. Just in an overall sense, Phil, like, I mean, when you look at some of the comments from either side, and there's, you know, Jurgen Klopp saying, well, this is not a title decider. Like, I can understand some of that. But at the same time, from a Liverpool point of view, like, it's easy to see how they could go ahead and beat Manchester City at the weekend. But given the run of results that they've been having, like, you look at the edging past Genk, who are like a mid-table Belgian A-League side, the late goal against Villa. They come from one down to beat Spurs. The United draw, the 2-1 Leicester, all the goals against Salzburg. Like, isn't that almost more of a concern from a Liverpool point of view, regardless of the result of the weekend, that actually sustaining that streak over the course of a season? At times they look like they're just hanging in.
Yeah, I wouldn't say hanging in, but I do get your point. And I've said it myself, so I can't go back on it, is that I don't feel Liverpool at times have gone out of second gear. We are sort of that good and that content that the good teams find a way of how to win games. It does get worrying where you say, you can't keep getting away with it. But we've been getting away with it for 2 or 3 years now, if that's the case, because this team's getting to a point in how they play. They can step a game up when they need to. They can certainly do it. I take exception to the Spurs game, because I thought the Spurs game was our best performance of the season. I thought it was absolutely terrific. But maybe that had something to do with going a goal behind in the first minute and having 89 minutes to put this right. Because Gazzaniga had an absolute worldie that day. But as I say, I get your point, because it's not been good enough. And I've heard Klopp a few times saying, we've got to start a little bit better. We went out against Villa and we were only players. We weren't warriors. So he's looking for that little bit more in games. But at the same time, you see where Liverpool are sitting, unbeaten this season, just the one draw and all those wins. Liverpool are finding a way. And all the great teams that you look at, even when I played, the great Manchester United sides that were winning the leagues. How many times last-minute goals? It doesn't go down to just luck. There is something special about your team and what you're creating. And that's what this team is good at the moment. Yes, I totally agree. I would like to see us be a bit more. The game against Genk, the game against other teams, we're not being as clinical in our finishing as we should be.
Yeah, and I think the statistics are incredible for Liverpool. I think at Anfield, the last six times they've gone behind in a match, they've gone on to win the match. So you would generally talk about character of a team in that sort of situation. And Phil, looking at that last month and the amount of late goals that Liverpool have scored in the final 20 minutes to go on and win matches and claim the point even against Manchester United, I think the games have generally had a similar pattern where Liverpool have been camped inside the opposition half for the second half and have eventually ground them down. And John Giles was saying last night, it is very similar to Manchester United in that one of the great things Liverpool do is they keep doing the same thing. They don't just start lumping it. They play the same way in the 90th minute as they do in the first minute. Against Manchester City, you can't see a situation, or maybe you can, where City are stuck inside their own half for long periods of the game. If City come and play and can grind out 50% possession, if not more, how do Liverpool respond to that?
I think City played Liverpool the biggest compliment last year when they came to Anfield, where they did sit back a little bit. I remember Kyle Walker coming on the television after the game and he says, we have to change. And him, and I don't know who the other fullback was, but we were told to stay further back and not venture forward. And I think that will probably be the same thing, because Pep came before and he had a go. And which is, this Manchester City team are absolutely wonderful. I love watching them play, and they can absolutely destroy teams. But that was a massive compliment. Will he do the same again? I would probably think so, because he's seen how Liverpool have struggled against a very, very low block unit, which allows Liverpool to have the ball and keep possession. And you have to try and sort of tire teams out. And maybe because Mo Salah's not been at it as much as Firmino and Mane, maybe that's why we've been lacking that little bit of creativity around the box to break teams down that we have. And it might be a little bit like that against Manchester City. They may sit back and look to hit us, because they have got unbelievable pace on the break. Liverpool are going to have to be aware of that. We've shown that we can struggle. This will be a Liverpool team, I believe, on Sunday. You heard Jurgen Klopp. I haven't heard him speak like that. He did an interview with Jeff Shreves, this guy. How much we're looking forward to this game. Everybody's looking forward to it. We're all ready, and it's one of the great games. And I'm going, I haven't heard him speak like that all season. So yeah. Liverpool will be up for it. Liverpool will be ready. And I think that's why we'll see another great Liverpool performance this weekend. I think City being the team they are, I just think they're absolutely one. I hope it's a great game. I really do. I hope it's one of those games where it's attack, counter-attack, defence. You see every concept of a game on Sunday. I think it'll be brilliant if it does.
Yeah, it's definitely got all the makings of being a great game. And like as you rightly say, one of the great fixtures in world football. How far is this fixture off being more important to Liverpool fans than the United game?
Do you know what, guys? I was actually thinking that. You know, when I was listening to the Jürgen Klopp thing, and he wasn't like that before the Man United game. And obviously, my biggest game, I'm a local lad, and my biggest game of the season is Everton, the derby match. Then it's Manchester United. Manchester United's always been a massive game, and you see the build-up to it that you guys get, everybody gives it. But this Manchester City team, where it's going, and if they keep spending the zillions that they've got on players to keep themselves at the top of the game, I think the rivalry could match something like that. If we stay at the top the way we are, obviously Pep will need to stay for many years and Klopp will need to stay. I believe they're so important to the both sides, and it could become that sort of a challenge for both sides.
And City to win, obviously, Phil.
Pardon?
City to win.
You're joking, after all, just what I've said. No, I do fancy Liverpool, and I look forward to having a chat with Ivan after we've beaten City on Monday. I'm going for a 2-0 win. And believe it or not, on Sky Bet, I've gone for Mo Salah to score the two.
Right, because he's the least effective from a goal perspective than all the
absolutely
forwards, I'm sure.
And he's going to come alive.
Phil, thanks a million. Enjoy
the
game.
My pleasure, guys. And I hope the game's a great game. Good luck. And say hi to Kenny for me.
I'd say you'll be hearing from him.
I don't know what that means.
We'll pass on your number.
I don't know what that means. That's sort of, you know, hey, say hi to Kenny. Yeah, that's interesting. Is it, for you, a rivalry that's close to... I mean, I know that there's so much that goes into a rivalry, and one of the main things is obviously tradition. So it doesn't have that, and it's not going to have that for...
No, I don't think it ever will have that.
...decades to come. But at the same time, it is... Like, if you sat down in terms of world football to think about one of the, you know, one of the games that you'd like to see at any...
Oh, no, this is the best game in world football.
Particular moment.
There is no question. Like, right now, these are the two best teams in world football.
Yeah.
And have proven that, and... The best thing about this game, with the exception of the 0-0 draw at Anfield last year, it's lived up to it. That game in January, which was Liverpool's last defeat against Manchester City, without question the best Premier League game I've ever seen in terms of quality. It was 100 miles an hour. Absolute non-stop. Yet, everybody did what they wanted to do with the ball when they got it. Like, executed all their skills perfectly. Technically, it was almost perfection. There was little or nothing between the sides. Remember, John Stones clearing off the line. It was as good as it gets.
11 millimetres.
It was as good as it gets. And this weekend, maybe the same. I think City would make a mistake adopting the same tactics as last year of sitting back, because I think Liverpool have shown this season that they figured out how to counter that.
Mm.
They just pummel the opposition to death.
Yeah.
They'll just go again and they don't get frustrated.
Yeah.
So it's not like a year ago or 2 years ago where if teams sat back, Liverpool didn't know what to do. Now they do. They just keep doing the same thing again and again and again, and eventually they get the reward.
Yeah, we'll see what City's response to that will be at the weekend. Delighted to say Richard Dunn joins us on the line now. Morning to you, Richard.
Morning.
We've just been going through it there with Phil Thompson. You can sort of predict what which side of the debate he fell down on. City, obviously, a few defensive concerns and some players definitely out for this weekend. Does that make you concerned about the outcome?
Yeah, I think it's right. I don't think Man City can sit back. I think with the defensive problems they have got, I think it'd be a mistake to sit back and try and hold out. I think they'll have to go and attack. But we know what they've got going forward. They've got some of the best attacking players in Europe, and regardless of what they've got defensively, I think they still carry a massive threat going forward, and they're more than capable of hitting Liverpool on the break or dominating the game even in midfield. We've seen when the goalie got sent off in midweek. They just kept the ball in the opposition's half and kept the ball away from their goal. So they're a very talented squad, and even with the injuries and the suspensions or whatever the players missing, they're still a big threat.
Just on that point about the counter-attack, Nathan was just talking there about sort of how City might go about obviously containing that Liverpool team, and we know the threat that comes from the two Liverpool wing-backs. What is it from a City point of view? Is that a case of having Sterling and Mahrez push on in a way that pins them back, or how do City go about containing that attack?
Normally
threat?
When they played against a back three with wing-backs, they've kept three forwards to keep the wing-backs defensive, and with Liverpool, their full-backs are almost wing-backs. They try and get forward all the time, so I think if Sterling and Mahrez or whoever it may be can play higher up the field, it will limit Robertson and Alexander-Arnold's attacking threat. So, yeah, I think they might try and play with the three up front, and keep them wide and keep them high and dominate down in the midfield area. So it'll be good because it'll be a tactical thing. I think both sides know how good the other is, and they're both a little bit wary of the threats from the other side. So I think tactically it will be important. And Liverpool themselves, I mean, as good as they have been, they've not kept a clean sheet for 7 or 8 games or something now. So they'll have a little doubt in their mind about overloading teams in the back.
The biggest loss for Manchester City with all these injuries is surely Aymeric Laporte, who's been their best defender and far and away their best defender, with Vincent Kompany having left the club. And Pep Guardiola's rotated. Fernandinho's back there. John Stones, Nicolas Otamendi, one of them will end up starting alongside Fernandinho. As a centre-half, how long does it take to establish a relationship where you totally understand what the other one's going to do? Like, sometimes does it just click, or is there always a bedding-in period of it takes 20, 30 games?
I think we're at, and I think you see with players when they move positions, they change positions, because generally they're good players. They can do the job over a short period of time, but the longer the time goes, they play out of position, they start to make more mistakes and more errors throughout the games. And I think for Man City, the possibility of whether it be Fernandinho or Otamendi or whoever, they'll get away with it. They'll get away with it in periods, but over the course of a season, they'll make too many mistakes between them, and they could click. They could have an amazing day and all that, but you don't see it as a consistent partnership or something that's going to be. It's going to be 10 out of 10 every week, you know. So for Man City, they know where the deficiencies are. They know they've got problems in that position, and they almost have to counteract it maybe with Gundogan playing a little bit deeper at times, or the fullbacks, because of the pace of Walker, and if it's Mendy who plays, they can get around the cover. So because that central position is a bit dodgy for them defensively, everyone else takes a step backwards or has it in their mind that they need to get back in cover a little bit more. So it affects the whole team. And in terms of building long-lasting partnerships, I think everybody in the team and everyone outside of the team, we all know it's never going to be a long-lasting partnership. So whether it ever will mount into something strong and defensive, I'm not too sure.
The frustration for Guardiola and for the City supporters must be that when you look at that partnership of Fernandinho and Otamendi in particular, like what you're talking about there is that Fernandinho is the one who's playing out of position, and that eventually, you know, he will make some mistakes. But the one who's been making the mistakes is Otamendi, who's the experienced centre-half, you know, played countless times at international level. He's 31 at this stage. Like, do you look at him and think he is a centre-back of the quality of Manchester City, looking to become European champions, looking to win 3 Premier League titles in a row? Is he at that level?
I don't think he's been at that level for 4 or 5 years. I don't think he's ever really reached it. I think he's been probably in a team that dominates a lot. So defensively, they probably don't have as much as a normal team. And also, he's been partnered with very strong defenders. So I think in one-on-one terms, he makes rash decisions. He runs out of position, and I don't think he's the same level as the other players in the team. But obviously, Pep sees some qualities in him in terms of coming out with the ball and passing it. But I think for a defender, if you were to compare him against Van Dijk, well, there really isn't a comparison. You know, Van Dijk can do both. He can come out with the ball and he can defend brilliantly. So you've always sort of over the last 10 years or whatever, since they've become such a good side, they've had one strong central defender. And I think for them, they've had one strong defender and one ball playing defender. And to go to win Champions League, you need two defenders who can defend one-on-one situations, who can hold the line properly, and who the rest of the team can rely on.
The way Liverpool defend and how high they defend, Damien Delaney has explained it very well, and I think he's played against that type of system where Liverpool playing practically everybody inside the opposition half and pinning them back so much and almost suffocating the life out of them that there's never really an out ball for the defensive team because they just have to clear it as far up the pitch. It's picked up again by Van Dijk or Matip. They recycle it, they get it forward quickly. As a centre-back, how difficult a job is that and how risky is it, do you think, for Liverpool to be playing Matip and Van Dijk and the two fullbacks even further forward? How risky is it to play everybody that far up the pitch, particularly against Manchester City this weekend?
Yeah, it is risky. I think it's for Liverpool, if they make one press which doesn't go correctly, there's an out ball straight away, you know, and they're high up the field and people can get in behind them. But what they've done is the pressing is that good that people can't get out. I think technically Man City are probably the best team in the league, so they're a side that can play quick 1-2 touch football and get in behind Liverpool. But we've seen Liverpool, we've seen them last season, we've seen them this season so far. They're brilliant. They're great at what they do and they're full of confidence. So I'm sure they're ready for balls over the top, and that's probably not what Man City want to do. They don't want to play the ball long and chase it and push up and that. But from time to time, that's necessary. And certainly with the speed of Sterling and the accuracy of maybe a long ball from Kevin De Bruyne, that could be a big threat for Liverpool if they're not. It's all right pushing high, but you've always got to be aware of the ball over the top, and you can't always be on the front foot going forward. You also have to have one eye on what's happening behind you.
Kenny Cunningham kicked off a bit of a debate earlier in the week, Richard, when he was on with us, and he was talking about Fabinho, and there's plenty of think that he is the embodiment of this Liverpool team this year, that he's one of the most improved players, that he's the fulcrum of all that's good, I suppose, about Liverpool. So there's plenty of counter-argument. But the essence of Kenny's point was that he's not a player in that position who necessarily senses danger, doesn't have the alertness. He said, you know, he doesn't have the legs to get across the pitch. What's your take on him?
On Fabinho?
Yes.
I think he's very good. I think he's more probably in the mould of what Michael Carrick used to do. He just recycles the ball and moves it, and he's in good positions. I agree, he's not lightning quick, and he's not going to make great recoveries, but similar to Fernandinho, again, he makes professional fouls, he takes little tugs of jerseys and stuff like that, so he disrupts play. For the way that Liverpool play, because they press so much, a lot of the ball from the opposition gets cleared into a central area, and he's very good at picking it up and starting the attacks again. So I think for what Liverpool use him for, I think he's been outstanding this season, and I think he's an important player for them.
What do you expect to happen on Sunday?
I hope it's like last year's game, last January's game, and it was just unbelievable football, and it was end to end, and I hope for more of the same. It's very difficult to call, because forever Man City are lacking defensively. They've got so much going forward. It's just whether they can match the intensity of Liverpool. And I think the games there previously, the crowd are up for it. Everyone seems to think it's the title decider almost. So it's going to be tough, and there won't be much in it. And rather than call a score, I'm just hoping for a really good game.
Just want, before we let you go, Richard, obviously the Ireland squad's been named for the big game against Denmark in a couple of weeks' time, and Kieran Clarke is one of the players who is back in. There's obviously going to have to be some shifting defensively for Ireland, with Richard Keogh now out. Who is it that's going to start alongside Shane Duffy if they do go with that four at the back?
I think Egan. I think he was very good in the last two games. He's done really well, and I think once you're in and you do well, if you've got the jersey, until you start making mistakes, you deserve to keep it. So I think Kieran's had a tough time over the last year, probably in terms of game time, but he's come back, and Newcastle looks stronger for him being back in the team. And he's a very good player to have in the squad, and in case there is any more issues.
Yeah, Richard, we're just a couple of weeks away from a big anniversary. Have yourself and Thierry any plans to mark the 10-year anniversary of that most memorable night in Paris?
Not yet. I don't know. He's not been seen, I don't think, since the Monaco situation out there. So
he's not welcome in your part of the world right now for many reasons.
No, he's just chatting about it last week, and time's flying past. So it's a long time ago, and hopefully we can have better memories this summer coming up, and we can get the points that we need over the next week and qualify.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Thanks, Richard.
Nice one, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Richard, on the line there. Ahead of that game of the weekend. So, Tom Malone is going to join us next on O2B AM to bring us the very latest in the world of sports news. 8:35 on this Friday morning. You're watching O2B AM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. Delighted that you could join us this morning. We're going to get that news from Tom in just a minute, but first we'll bring you this. Niall Quinn at our Virgin Media Sport Roadshow in Dundalk on Monday night.
I'll tell you a quick Bernie Slaven story.
I had a feeling there was going to be a Bernie Slaven story.
Oh, jeez, you're after opening a treasure trove of stories up there. So one of our players famously went missing from the dressing room just before the game. It was a qualifier against Malta, I think, at home. And Paul didn't attend the game. He got off the bus and went back out to the hotel. And Jack had to reshuffle things. And Bernie, who wasn't named in the 16, was brought in as sub. He had no boots with him. And Noel King gave him his boots. Noel was the coach at the time. And he sat on the bench, said nothing to nobody. And with 10 minutes to go, he got called off the bench, took his tracksuit off, and he had 22 signatures on his jersey that he'd got signed for a raffle in mail. So an Ireland international World Cup qualifier, played with the coach's boots and a jersey signed with it. It was just brilliant time to play football.
Now, Quinn, in conversation with Nathan in Dundalk on Monday night, that full show available on offtheball.com. It is 8:36. Tom Malone, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you doing, Emil?
Very good.
Ready to go.
Michael O'Neill, is he on the move? Is he staying?
Yeah, apparently it's imminent. Northern Ireland captain Stephen Davis says it'll be a huge blow if manager Michael O'Neill leaves. He's expected to be named as the new Stoke boss this afternoon. And Davis says he doesn't want O'Neill to depart.
I've spoke many times about how big Michael's been for the country and how big a part he's been in terms of us getting that success. And if he does decide to go, ultimately we knew that day would come at some point, but it'll be a huge blow for us.
They've shown some capacity to kick on a little bit under Michael O'Neill. Like, he's obviously a rated manager now in the back of the work he's done there. What less of a proposition are Northern Ireland without him?
Well, the problem is for Northern Ireland, much like the Republic of Ireland, we're heading into a World Cup qualifying campaign where it's going to be nigh on impossible for them to qualify because it's so difficult to get in. The talk seems to be Michael O'Neill's going to stay on for the two games against the Netherlands.
But it's the Netherlands and Germany.
So what Northern Ireland have done brilliantly under Michael O'Neill is they've played slightly above their level. So the way this group has worked out, they played their first four games against Estonia and Belarus and won all four of them. And that's sort of what he's brought Northern Ireland to, which is they win the games they should win and they're bloody hard to play against the better teams.
What any small nation would kind of hope
exactly.
for.
Exactly. And he's explained very well, I think, how organised he is. And I think that's very much what Stoke would want, that they should beat the teams. That's what they were under Tony Pulis. They're 10th in the table, they beat the bottom 10, and they make life difficult for the 10 above them. Now's the time to go, though, because after these two matches, what do Northern Ireland have? A Nations League playoff, where in all likelihood they're going to be away from home in the first match, probably against Bosnia, and then potentially playing the Republic of Ireland in the final. They don't come through that. They've nothing. So you may have only, after this, two more games, competitive games, in the next year. And his stock is as high as it's going to be. He has no proven track record in English football. So as much as we can talk about the Michael O'Neill, Martin O'Neill comparison, Martin O'Neill's stock is still way higher, I would say, in English football than Michael O'Neill's. Rightly or wrongly, and regardless of their modern coaching ability, unfortunately, that's the way football works.
Well, exactly.
Especially for those kind of teams where you need to... It's so important. They just need to win games, and like that's why the likes of Pulis and Allardyce get those gigs to get teams up the table.
This is a great job for Michael O'Neill.
The reality is
Stoke are one of the best four teams in the championship. Yeah. Resource wise, they've
huge
got another
budget.
Couple of years of the parachute payments. He's
going
to get a lot of money.
They're in Denise Coates and Bet365. They will pump money into that. They're massive
at the
local
bottom
business.
Of the league.
Yeah.
So the only way is up. So technically, survival this season is probably what they'll say is the aim. I wouldn't rule out Stoke if things go well, pushing on and trying to get into the playoffs before the end of this season.
Obviously, he's not thinking about it this way, and it's all about Stoke. But like the shelf life of a manager in the Championship is way less than a year anyway. The average.
Yeah.
It's about this for Michael O'Neill is a massive career move, and if he can make a half decent job of it at Stoke. For me, it's not even about that. Like, he'll inevitably part ways with Stoke at some point in a way that with Northern Ireland, he could have been there for another could have been there for life.
Well, he can now, if this goes well.
Yeah, you get into that cycle, well, don't you?
He's on that merry-go-round.
It could be Sam Allardyce.
Yeah.
This is the carrot.
But maybe we're underestimating Michael O'Neill. Maybe actually, and football has a funny way with these things, he does well with Stoke, and in a year's time, a Premier League manager is getting fired, and Michael O'Neill has put Stoke in a great position, and he gets that gig, because suddenly he has a big body of work behind him. And that's how these things can go. But if this goes well, he's set up for the next 10 years.
Pints of wine at whenever he wants.
Yeah.
We all like a pint of wine, Adrian, over Christmas period.
Let's move on to the Europa League.
As much as anybody else there, Adrian.
Take exception to that.
Oh dear.
Celtic and Manchester United booked their places in the last 32 of the Europa League with two games to spare last night. Celtic did so in pretty dramatic fashion as Olivier Cham scored in the fifth minute of added time in Rome to get the better of Lazio by 2-1. Things are much easier for Manchester United. They had a 3-0 win over Partizan Belgrade. Greenwood, Martial and Rashford with the goals, and Red Devils boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was happy with that.
This is a little bit of a template on how we want to play, definitely. But of course, it's the opposition that allow you to play this way as well. No disrespect to Partizan, but they gave us spaces.
Yeah, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer there. Rangers, meanwhile, boosted their hopes of progress with a 2-0 win over Porto at Ibrox, and an injury time royal Jimenez goal gave Wolves a 1-0 win over Slovan Bratislava at Molineux. Tonight at Windsor Park, it's the first leg of the inaugural Unite the Union Champions Cup tonight. SSC Airtricity Premier Division winners Dundalk are away to Northern Ireland Premiership winners Linfield. They get underway there in Belfast at 7:45. While there's a basement battle in the Premier League at Carrow Road tonight, Norwich City entertain winless Watford with a kick-off there at 8 o'clock. Boss Daniel Farke says tonight is a chance to kickstart the season, but he wouldn't go so far as to say it's a must-win game.
If we win this game, it's not like we can open a bottle of champagne and celebrate that we will stay in this league. And if we lose this game, it's not like we have to give up because there's still so many games to play. And of course, an important game, but we're also far away from over-interpreting it. It's not a cup final.
In golf, Shane Lowry's hoping for better on day two of the Turkish Airlines Open. The Open champion was highly critical of the greens on day one and starts 7 shots off the pace on level par. Poor Carrington will tee off on 3 over par. Tom Lewis and Matthias Schwab then led jointly on 7 under par. Meanwhile, Tiger Woods, in what is a complete affront to subtlety, he named himself as one of his wildcard picks for the President's Cup. And if you go onto his Twitter, there's one of the greatest and least subtle videos of all time when he announces himself as playing captain as well. It's got everything, you know, clapping in the background, USA chants, all
as
his
captain,
stats.
I'm going to choose Tiger Woods as the last player on the team.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's just go on to his Twitter, which is, you know, usually just him flogging golf balls and watches and cars, or, you know, with trophies and boasting and stuff. And this is just, it's right up there.
I'll tell you what, Tom, when you're the greatest sports person of all time,
I know,
you can tweet what you want.
Exactly. He also
had sport.
He deserves it.
He actually does deserve it, but it's amazing. It's
also,
well,
it's the President's Cup. The greatest waste of time in all of sport.
It really is.
It's kind of Ryder Cup prep, is that the?
No, yeah. I mean, well, essentially,
it's the rest of the world minus Europe. Yeah.
Okay.
He also added Tony Finau, Gary Woodland, and Patrick Reed. There's a bit of who had that. That Spieth didn't get in, but he had no right to be on the team.
But it's strange that Spieth wasn't really in consideration, even considering how far he's fallen. And like Ricky Fowler wasn't picked and also wasn't really in consideration. I think Spieth should have been in because he's just a ridiculous competitor.
Yeah.
And also is going to bounce back, and it's going to look foolish in a year or two's time that he wasn't included. And he just has, like, him or Patrick Reed in terms of team morale.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. Patrick Reed in a team environment.
Can I recommend, Adrian, by the way, a wonderful episode of Golf Weekly that's up now on offtheball.com.
Sure.
We had Stephanie Meadow in studio for the entire Golf Weekly.
Right.
She's very interesting. I don't know if you saw this a couple of months back. She earned her LPGA Tour card on the final.
By winning it?
No, she came sixth. So she knew playing the final hole that she needed to birdie it.
Yes.
Oh my God.
To finish in the top six and hold a 25-footer. And she was just brilliant on the psychology of it, of that her problem is she doesn't get pumped up enough, that talking to her sports psychologist, they're like, you need to be emotional.
Yeah.
You need to feel like it all matters.
Oh my God.
That's when you play at your best. Whereas most golfers, it's tone it down. Don't think about anything. She was like, actually, she doesn't think she would have made that putt if it didn't mean anything. The very fact that there was so much on it. But she was telling the story how she was playing with Georgia Hall, who's the former Women's British Open champion. They're very good friends and they were playing together alongside Imbie Park. And both Georgia Hall and Stephanie Miller are in tears on the 18th, and Imbie Park's looking at them like you've just finished fifth. Yeah. What are you celebrating for? This absolute look of disgust. And she had to go over and explain. It's like, no, I've just made my card for next year.
Where can you get this great podcast?
Offtheball.com.
Right. Sounds great.
I get the sense you're going to be tuning in.
Sure.
Every week. Yeah. Every week. Rugby, meanwhile, there's a clutch of Irish internationals looking to put their World Cup disappointment behind them on the pitch. Tonight, Connacht play host to Leinster in the first Inter-Pro of the season in the Pro 14. Robbie Henshaw, Keane Healy, Andrew Porter, Luke McGrath, Rob Kearney all start for Leinster, while Jack Carty's restored to the out-half jersey for the hosts, with Bundy Aki on the bench there, and getting it away at 7:35.
And don't forget,
I feel kind of obliged to ask if you're looking forward to Logan Paul against CSI Miami for the weekend.
Yeah, can't wait.
Actually, looking blankly at me.
No, well, I like the element that before they promoted it themselves and they got all the cash, and Eddie Hearn saw that and went, "Wait a minute, why didn't I get some of that action?" Yeah,
where's it on?
Sky Sports,
the Staples Center.
Yeah, the two YouTubers. I'm not massively familiar with their YouTube.
Googling Logan Paul.
I feel as if we should wait for you to say something, but then you might also just text your wife. So
I'm just checking out who Logan Paul is to confirm if he's the person I think he is.
It's a quarter to nine. I mean, quarter to nine on this Friday, but he's not the person Nathan thought he was. Breaking news.
Apologies about that.
Got the yellow banner going across the bottom of the screen there. Lots more to come, but right now, Tom, by the way, thanks, William, for that.
Cheers.
We're going to discuss the latest events in Mayo GAA. This is the standoff between the Mayo GAA and the Mayo International GAA Supporters Foundation over €250,000 that was raised for certain projects. And the foundation had asked a number of questions of the county board in relation to those projects and in relation to other money raised and governance and sponsorship. And the county board have met three times in the last 9 days. Most of those have been behind closed doors, including last night, where the media were not permitted to access it. So that was why we sent our media man, Owen Sheehan, to the scene.
Thursday night lights in Castlebar for an emergency county board meeting. Locked away in camera for over 3 hours, it was expected that the county board would clarify the events of Monday night. Was there a legitimate vote of confidence put forward in the county board executive, and did the club support it? Well, there was no comment forthcoming from any of the attendees in the immediate aftermath. Lads, can I get a quick word on the meeting tonight?
Absolutely not.
And certainly no comment from County Board Chairperson Mike Kennelly. Folks, I just grab a question since media weren't allowed in tonight, just on what happened at the meeting.
Paul will be issued a statement.
What's your own opinion on media not being allowed into county board meetings?
Look, Paul, as I said, will be issuing a statement, and that's the way it'll be.
You think it's fair that the people in Mayo don't know what's going on?
I mean, you have to look at other counties, what's happening.
Do you think that other counties are right to do so? Will it be revisited?
It's quite possible. Delegates will decide that.
And in the vote of no confidence today, was that brought up again?
The statement
did in fact arrive soon after, but there was still no clarity on pretty much all the big questions that remain. County Board PRO Paul Canan also declined to comment. This story, as you would expect, is going nowhere, and it really is the talk of Castlebar Town.
Well, indeed it is. It is a sad thing too as well. Not alone the talk of the town, the talk of the country, the talk of the county. We had 3 years talking and listening to people about Brexit. This is as bad, and it's a pity too as well. But I'm hopeful, and I'm genuinely hopeful, that it'll be resolved sooner rather than later. It's sad to think that we're in the news again for all the wrong reasons. You know, the thing about football, the thing about sport, everybody has an opinion. There's a huge Mayo following. People think they're right, other people think they're wrong, and whatever people think, it's their own opinion. But I am hopeful, definitely hopeful, and I sincerely do wish that the thing would be resolved sooner rather than later.
You can nearly literally hear Mayo GAA tearing itself apart. It's on everyone's lips. It's the main topic of conversation. It's so sad to see, because Mayo GAA is so embedded in our society here. And for once, there's a real bad feeling around Mayo GAA. And, we're renowned as such supporters that can take any amount of hurt. But that's on the field. I think the hurt we're feeling now is different. It's more serious. It's more in the soul of Mayo GAA. And I think that has really torn people to shreds, really.
I suppose, how much time do you have, really? I mean, it's a long-running saga that
unfortunately, you know, only puts Mayo in the headlines for the wrong reasons again at this time of year. It seems every year Mayo don't win the All-Ireland, they still somehow become the story towards the end of the year. My own thoughts on it are just that it's been handled very badly, probably on both sides, to be fair. You know, to give the county board a bit of credit, is that they have been blindsided at times by some of the letters that or emails that have been sent to them, maybe the timing right before meetings and that. But then they don't do themselves any favours by having meetings in camera, and then almost immediately what happens in that meeting gets out. You have clubs then saying, hang on, you're saying something happened that didn't happen. And it just begins to kind of beggar belief as to what's actually going on. Do the executive know themselves what their plan is, what they need to do? And then on the other side of things, are they being pushed a little bit too hard maybe at times by Tim O'Leary and the foundation?
Do you think that Tim O'Leary and the foundation, the Mayo Supporters Foundation, should just hand over the money at this point to Mayo GAA and let Mayo County Board do what they want with the money?
Oh, not by all means. I meant to say, look, because if you're sponsoring something, and let's be, even myself here, from week to week, somebody comes in and looks for sponsorship. But you feel that when you give something to somebody, if it's only a voucher for a meal, that you want to know where the voucher's going, where it's spent properly. You know, it's money well earned by somebody. Mm. And matter who or she is, let it be 1,000 or 500,000, let's be honest about it, that money had to be earned somewhere. So there should be a little transparency, no doubt about it. From that, from money point of view, doesn't matter what size it is, if you give a euro to a child, you want to know where he's going with it. In the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I was nominated last night by my club, Ballycroy, to be the next Mayo GAA PRO. And I feel eminently qualified to do that. I people are calling for professionals to be brought into the Mayo County Board the same way as you often hear people saying Michael O'Leary should be brought in to run the health service. You know, the people look for professionals. I'm a journalist for 20 years. So I see it from both sides. I absolutely can understand the volunteerism and the hard work of anyone involved in a county board, but I see that we've got to tell our story in a much more professional manner, in a transparent manner, in a manner that brings our community with us, and in a way that certainly doesn't insult any supporter of ours, whether they're a millionaire or whether they're a season ticket holder.
Well, I used to work for CRCFM, the local community station here in Castlebar. Did a bit of work for Midwest Radio as well and the local newspapers, but mostly CRCFM, where I was the sports editor. And, you know, we covered Mayo GAA. I mean, they're the biggest show in town in the county, regardless of sports. I mean, soccer, rugby, sports like that have their place, but Mayo GAA is what makes Mayo tick, a lot of people will say. You know, if the county team are doing well, the county's doing well, and vice versa. I often found myself running into brick walls when it came to dealing with Mayo GAA in particular, trying to get into press conferences, you know, media nights before Connacht matches, before big matches. For example, I always went to the Connacht launch of the Connacht Championship without any issue. An invitation was sent to the radio station, no issues at all. With Mayo then, you were contacting them to see when it was on. You were nearly begging to be let in the door. At times, we weren't let in the door. We were physically stopped at the door.
It seems to be the only country. It amuses me. You know, you never hear it about Kerry, you never hear it about Dublin, because they keep all these things in-house. But I just think the fact that Mayo is such a big county, no more than the two that I mentioned too as well, and they have such a huge following, and, you know, it's just a pity that we have to talk about it in the close season. Like last weekend, we had a historic moment here in Castlebar when our own Paddy Durkin got an All-Star, first time Castlebar Mitchell's man ever did. And, you know, it was still the second item in conversation after the rumblings of the county board and Mr. O'Leary.
Oh, good morning to you. Good
morning, lads. How are things?
Where do we go from here?
Pray, clearly, is the only place we can go right
knock,
now.
Hit knock, hit knock.
Yeah, possibly. I see there's a few new routes coming out of Knock, so you can fly people in from Barcelona if you want to get in and pray at the shrine what's going on. And I don't think you're too far off the mark, Nathan. If you were disillusioned with the situation and you went to McHale Park last night, you certainly wouldn't be feeling any better about the situation, to put it that way. Not much has happened in the public eye because they've said nothing, despite the fact that they had a meeting that went from 8 p.m. past, till about 11 last night, that was dubbed an emergency meeting, a statement that said nothing afterwards, a meeting that included no media inside. This is a closed shop, whatever you wanted to discuss. This is not getting out to the public. This is not getting out to the people of Mayo. It's not getting out to the wider country. But really, it doesn't matter about the wider country. It does matter about Mayo, first and foremost here. There are people walking the streets of Castlebar this morning who are like, what the hell actually happened with that emergency meeting with the most powerful people in our county board? They don't have a clue, basically. And you will see stuff in the rumour mill. Everybody will get stuff in the rumour mill. But that's what we've got to operate now when it comes to a fairly important story in the GAA.
So they wouldn't speak to you last night. They issued a statement, as you say, which basically said absolutely nothing. There's a degree of contempt, obviously, here for they're wrapping it up in a contempt for the media, which is ultimately a contempt for Mayo GAA fans, as I see it. We're sitting in a vacuum now, right? Like, there's no information forthcoming from Mayo GAA. We discussed earlier that I actually understand that if they did want to, at some point, say that obviously there's a legal sensitivity here and that's something that deserves discussion behind closed doors before we come out and tell the public exactly what the plan is, whether that's changing positions on the county board, whether they go back for a re-election, where they're at with that vote of confidence, what's happening with the funds, whatever it might be, I would understand that. But as we sit now, that statement has not indicated that in 1 week's time we're going to tell everybody what the plan is.
This has been a complete and utter PR car crash for Mayo GAA. There is no two ways about it. They, to a point, had a situation that was quite controllable a couple of weeks ago because, as you say, Adrian, they had the legal argument to lean on and there was full legitimacy in that. I have full sympathy for Mayo a few weeks ago when you have this big figure with a lot of money abroad who wants to pump money into your organisation, who also ran this event in a country that have very tough taxation laws. He needs his receipts. He needs to see where the money is going. You can see where it's coming from on his side, but it is also unique from Mayo's point of view. People don't get elected to county boards because they know how to deal with millionaires. That's not part of the county board setup. So I had sympathy for Mayo on that level. I had sympathy for them keeping the dealings with Tim O'Leary behind closed doors because of the reported solicitor letters coming through. But I don't have sympathy for this weird blanket ban across the media, the way they've managed to try and get through a vote of confidence this week. They've made life quite difficult for themselves this week. They were in a situation where it was controllable, as I say, but they've just made it a hell of a lot worse. And the question marks have just got bigger now. They had a bad situation and it's 10 times worse than it was when it started.
Like, it's very simple. From a PR point of view, as Owen says, it's been a car crash because if you have nothing to hide, why try and hide something? Why try and keep the media out? Why not give people the openness and transparency that they need? Because Tim O'Leary and the Mayo Foundation are asking a lot of questions. They're generally quite specific about receipts, about certain amounts of money, around tickets and various promises that were made. There's a list of questions that need to be answered. Come out and answer them. And okay, county board meetings can be, and like it's funny, Owen says, you know, nobody knows what's happened. The general way this week has gone, we may well find out what's happened because there's been leaks of county board in-camera meetings. The doors were closed, but people have been recording them and getting them out there. Now, it turns out county board meetings aren't that exciting when you have to listen to one for an hour and a half. But like, I just thought it was incredibly disappointing that when you spoke to Mike Kennelly there, the chairman of the county board, that his answer is, look at other counties. Like, who cares about other counties? Yeah. There's a shit show all over the country, and like this feels like it's a tipping point in the last month with Mayo and Galway as to what's happening with county boards and what's happening with finances. But Mayo should pride themselves of being different and being above what is the basic bottom line standard. It's one of the best supported counties in the country. They have, over the last decade, produced an unbelievable football team that people in Mayo are rightly proud of. And the county board need to be at that standard as well. And need to answer questions. So to say, look at other counties, look over there, well, they're even worse than we are. Like, that's not good enough. Stand over. You're in charge of Mayo GAA. Come out, answer the questions and put this to bed. Because this is going to go on and on and on. And it's going to dog the senior inter-county team as much as anything else. And it's clearly going to have an effect on the county team and football in Mayo. Because how can they do anything else while this is hanging over everybody? Now, part of the problem going forward is, like, what does happen next? Like, straight away, the obvious thing is people are calling for the heads of the county board. Well, again, it does feel very similar in a way to a lot of the controversy around the FAI. Like, if the county board, the current county board, go, well, who steps in? Like, there's no, suddenly we look around and we find the 10 best businessmen at Mayo and go, you wouldn't step in there and volunteer to be the county board chairman.
Yeah, well, they're not full-time administration roles, is the key difference with the FAI.
There's a couple of full-time, and there's a couple of staff members, obviously, in and around Mayo GEA. But, like, next in line will be the delegates who stood by and accepted all this and gone, fair enough.
There's no straws in the wind on down there. I know you have to go in the next couple of minutes. No straws in the wind in terms of, like, what even the expectation around the next step is.
No, there's really no idea what's going to happen here, like in the specifics of the O'Leary case. Like, it's interesting what Nathan says there in terms of trying to, you know, not look at other counties in terms of what they've done. And I definitely agree with that on the specific point of the banishing media from the county boards. We'll get over that eventually. It's the sort of idea, though, of what this represents for Mayo and what this represents perhaps for the GEA as a whole. And I do have a little bit of sympathy for them on that regard, that perhaps they are the guinea pig in this, in a mini revolution when it comes to corporate structures in the GEA. Will it now become a situation where every county board needs to have expertise that can deal with huge money-making people abroad? Like, a lot of county boards go abroad and make a lot of money when they go abroad. Perhaps county boards don't have the expertise to do that. Maybe the first step is actually owning up from the county board and saying, we've made mistakes here. We're maybe perhaps a bit careless. We can get this sorted with Tim O'Leary. Ironically, the one good move, the best thing that I've seen the county board do over the course of the last few weeks, is actually Paul Cannan, the PRO, coming out and apologising for playing shoot a donkey in that underdog game. This is the first time we've actually seen somebody from Mayo GEA come out, hold their hands up and say, listen, I did something wrong. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. Not only are Mayo GEA human beings, they're dealing with financial things here that perhaps they haven't dealt with before. And perhaps if they all just stepped back and were a little bit more transparent and said, we have a problem on our hands here, they might have the backing of the county, they might have the backing of a few more people to actually be able to get through this. But no, who knows what's going to happen next, especially with the situation with Mr. O'Leary.
Yeah, part of the difficulty is we don't know if they've made mistakes. We don't know exactly what the situation is, whether everything's been run as smoothly as it could have been, and we just don't know about that.
No, and I agree with Owen, without wanting to go all Joe Brawley on it, I think this does raise huge questions for the GAA as to why even we need a Mayo International Supporters Foundation that seems to be based largely around the senior inter-county team. Okay, it's great to get private investment into the county, and I do think actually all money that is raised outside should be funneled through the county board, and they should get to decide where it goes, whether it's to underage academies, whether it's to infrastructure, whatever, that it shouldn't be just, well, we're giving money and the vast chunk of it is going to the senior inter-county team. But it has to, because of the sheer expense. Like, we're in a situation where a dinner was organised in New York last May, and the organisation of the dinner cost 250 grand. The dinner itself cost 250 grand. They raised a lot of money. But like, is that what the GEA is about? Dinners, five-star dinners in New York.
So ultimately
that cost 250 grand.
And that money is just lost out of, that's like an agent's fee. It's like, well,
it's to pay for the dinner. It's the organisation of the
day. But it's like some hotel or whatever in New York.
Exactly.
Quids in.
So again, I do think that the Mayo International Supporters Foundation need to probably show a little bit more transparency themselves. They have shown the figures, and they're the ones who've come out and said, actually, here's what we spent on the dinner, here's where the money went, there was donations to charity, here's what the county board were given, here's what they should be given. But who are the Mayo International Supporters Foundation? Aside from Tim O'Leary, who are the other people involved? Who are the people who are supplying money? Who are the people that are annoyed? I think we should get a full list of names so that they're looking for transparency on one side. We should have it on both sides. But like, where does this go? Like, a secret of county board meeting again last night. Is there going to be another one next Monday night? Funnily enough, there's a lunch in Dublin today.
Right.
A fundraising lunch for the Mayo Inter-County team at the Shelburne Hotel.
The one thing that I think it will do in terms of where it goes from here is that it will enlighten the general public who contributed to these events. They crop up all the time at any county that's worth their salt in terms of trying to do a bit of fundraising. They crop up all the time, and generally there's a non-questioning aspect of, I'm going to turn up and give my couple of hundred quid to my county because they deserve it, and you know, I think they should have the best possible facilities, etc. But there'll be more of a questioning now. You would hope that if you are one of those people who's turning up to one of those events, you're like, who are this group that I'm giving this money to, and where's that money going to be spent, in a way that I don't think those questions are asked now.
Well, people don't want to be embarrassed, and Owen, your sense from being on the ground, and I'm always wary, particularly when we talk about Mayo, that there's such a huge diaspora of Mayo people, that people in Dublin and around the world seem to spend a lot of time talking on behalf of the people who actually live on the ground and the volunteers on the club, in terms of, like, I think part of the reason the clubs came out and made their statements is that they were embarrassed. Suddenly there was this backlash that all the clubs that sat by and gave this resounding vote of confidence in the county board, and they were like, wait a second, actually, we didn't do that. We didn't do that. And we're getting slated for something we didn't do. Like, what's the sense on the ground in Castlebar? Do people actually genuinely care about this, do you think, Owen, or is it some sort of a sideshow that we're excited about but that the general public don't really care less about?
No, it matters hugely. And even just on the specific Castlebar thing, the idea that Castlebar Mitchells were one of the clubs that came out this week and actually said, hold on a minute, was that actually vote of confidence, was huge news. I think somebody compared him to Real Madrid or something like that, and I had a conversation yesterday saying, like, this is a huge club coming out against their own organisation. This was a huge moment, and for the people of Castlebar, seeing their club actually coming out and saying that was a big thing. But it's not just a bit of scandal. It's something that seems to have seeped a little bit deeper, I think. People are, maybe it is because of the number of scandals we've had over a couple of years, but people are fed up with this. The number one thing Mayo people want this at this point is for it to just go away, for it to get sorted out, and for it to go away. But perhaps there is a deeper appreciation at this point that because we've had so many of these instances over the last couple of years, perhaps there is a deeper look required in terms of what the structures are in the county. Maybe that's a little bit unfair on Mayo, but it does seem that this one has just got a little bit deeper into the skin than any of the previous times we've been talking about Mayo in the off-season. This one is kind of dividing people as well in terms of what side of the fence you should be on. And like, this needs to just get out into the open a little bit more and sort of this side of Christmas, because if this rages on into the new year, you don't know what sort of material impact it could have on the players or anything like that. They've been quiet, obviously, as you'd expect them to be. James Horne hasn't said anything. This thing could just rumble on and on and on, and that is not going to help preparations if it goes past convention, which is on, I think, the 13th of December.
How was your Castlebar medium?
it was lovely, actually. Yeah, it was in Nick Burns' pub, medium and chips. Went down and got a sausages and chips from Supermax, put it beside just over a 3/4 full pint of Guinness, one pour, and that is a medium and chips, the speciality. It was gorgeous.
Explain. I thought the medium and chips was the sausage and chips.
No, a medium is the pint where it's almost pulled to the top, and it's done in one pull, and that's it. Yeah.
I thought that was something that we sort of laughed at Americans for, who came in and saw the pint being 3/4 full and then just started drinking. You're like, no, hang on a second.
Is it because it's like closing time and they just have to get it done as quick as possible?
Potentially. I think it did start as like a joke, or somebody might have pulled away their pint without waiting for it in his pub before, and they actually enjoyed it very much. So he's kind of made it. Like, he doesn't throw them out. He suggested he gave it to me, and I don't think he'd be putting... I don't think he'd ask you to pay for a medium, for example, put it that way. I think it's just kind of a novelty thing that he does in the pub.
He didn't have to pay for it.
Like, I mean, it's...
What?
Gets him a lot of free
advertising. He's drawn out three Guinness.
What he wants is for us to be talking about the medium right now. I'm sure he's got his wish.
I think what's happened is they've just taken a hand out of you, is what's happened.
I was just going to say, there was so much good journalism for the last 24 hours, and then it turned out you were taking the free drink from them.
And they were also taking the piss out of you with giving you this, like, Guinness, that one pour. Nobody's ever heard of that.
Did you hear about that idiot from Kerry who came down and was drinking the 3/4 filled pint and was telling everybody about it?
It's like the greatest thing ever. Good luck.
You're probably more than correct. Thank you. Good luck.
Save home. Come on, Owen. I think maybe we should do this more often, send Owen out to provincial towns. And
no, 100%.
The only difficulty is after a while people are going to start waving purple things behind him.
Essentially, he's doing that Jack Charlton thing of, you know, paying for everything by cheque because nobody's ever going to cash it.
Sign it, and he didn't get my purple...
Your purple what?
Reference. People are going to start crowding behind him. At a certain point, people are going to realise, oh, he's in town. Well, you know. Early.
That's what we want.
It's past. It's Friday morning. We're going to put everybody out of the misery of talk rugby next here on OTBAM. Alan Quinlan is going to join us in the studio. First, here's Brian O'Driscoll discussing Saracens on Wednesday night rugby.
This has been touted for quite a number of years. This is not a rumour that sprung from nowhere. And you know, it was interesting. I read an article today about from. Chris Robshaw, and he seemed particularly annoyed, and someone put it, you know, doesn't seem an awful lot that gets Chris Robshaw really riled up, but this was one thing, and he felt as though over the course of Quinn's won in 2012 and all of a sudden, because of the salary cap, they weren't able to keep the level. As their profiles rose with that success, you know, so needed their you know, incomes to rise and so on, and interest in other clubs. And so they weren't able to pick and choose, maybe, to keep all the players that they had wanted to keep. And who was it in the backs? I remember Brown, Manya, and Jordan Turner Hull. Were the ones to sign first, but the one to lose out was David Strettel, because his profile was rising. And where did he go? To Saracens. And Rob Shaw, you know, or this article made reference to, they felt as though Conor O'Shea was squeezed out of the club because he simply felt as though he couldn't compete with what was going on. So this has been a dirty secret for a while, and not so much of a secret. And the talk is that there's other clubs that, you know, potentially have a case to answer as well, and this isn't solely Saracens that the inquiry is going to be around. So we'll have to wait and see. There's a lot to be played, more to be played out in this.
Yeah, it's Brian Driscoll on Wednesday Night Rugby this week. You can check out that full piece on offtheball.com. Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you getting on?
Very good, no? Yeah, yourself?
I was kind of thinking there wasn't too much rugby to chat about, and then all these stories start to bubble under, and Danny Kerr picks up the point about Saracens in the Times this morning, just about the impact that has. Like, it was interesting listening to Leo Cullen during the week talking about it and saying, like, we're not bitter about it. It struck me that Michael Conlon was on with the lads during the week, and he was talking about doping and boxing, and he was saying that, like, he was calling it out, and he was saying, like, you know, I believe that there are a lot of people operating at the top level of boxing who are doping, and it's an unfair playing field. Like, there's a level of that. There's an aspect of that about this Saracen story, that they were operating at an unfair playing field from everybody else.
Yeah, and they had a breach in 2015, hadn't they? So it seems to have continued, and Chris Robshaw has gone hard on it as well. The Exeter owner, a lot of people have been speaking in the Premiership, and Exeter are probably the ones that can feel the hardest done by, because they lost a couple of titles to them. Yeah. So it is an unfair playing field. I think to get your head around the scenario of a salary cap, maybe it's not fair, not right that you're restricted. But it is to try and create a fairly level playing field around the finances, and not have one team with huge investment being able to invest huge amounts of money on players. And there's probably an argument to say that, well, if you're privately owned, that you should be allowed to do that. But there's a salary cap there for a reason, and whether you like it or not, and they've breached it. They're saying investments aren't salary. That's what Nigel Ray was saying, and it's just very strange that a number of players have companies set up, and that there's money being put into these companies. And I'd heard about stuff before. We've all heard rumours, and I suppose Danny Kerr and Chris Robshaw and these guys have heard it, particularly being close to, you know, one of their rivals in London. So I've heard of offshore payments and stuff like that for overseas players and stuff. To get around the salary cap. So they've appealed it now, so it's obviously going to be kicked down the road a little bit, and it's a very severe punishment to be docked 35 points and over 5 million. But if they knowingly, they're saying that they didn't knowingly try to deceive anyone, but I think the investigation has been going on 9 months, and someone independently came in and made the decisions and went through the whole system. So it seems to be pretty black and white that they have breached a salary cap, and if they have done that, they deserve punishment.
Yeah, and like a minute, as you said, they'll probably argue that it was unknowingly, and that's their way out of it. Obviously, and you can understand.
It's hard to believe that it was.
Look, if that's what they're arguing, that's going to be the case of it.
It's not severe. Like, the punishment is not severe. Like, they should be stripped of the titles that they've won over the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, I think give it to the teams that were closest to them. I'd be with you.
Yeah, like, and even then, it's not enough, because. What, is there something?
No, go ahead.
Why are you saying that?
No, nothing. Go ahead.
Okay, grand. But, like, sport is about moments. Like, the joy of winning the league and winning the Premiership is the moment you lift the trophy and the celebration and the days afterwards. Like, you always talk about this. It's the dressing room.
Yeah.
Like, you can't replicate that for the Exeter players, what they've missed out on.
And it's like someone cheating at the Olympics or an athletics event where a medal is taken off them, and someone is pushed up and wins a bronze or a silver or a gold, it's devalued at that stage. But I think
at the very least,
if, yeah, it
they should be stripped
the titles,
of the title.
If it's proven, I think the titles should be taken off them. The Premiership titles, Europe, it's different. You can't the salary cap scenario isn't there for Europe. But you could argue that because of the ability to sign X number of players over the salary cap and do deals with players to get them into the club, that it makes him stronger in Europe as well. So I can see Leo Cullen why he's, you know,
they just have to beat the team that they're up against.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard if you start engaging in that kind of chat from a head coach point of view.
Yeah, it is. But like in fairness to them, they're an incredible side, and that performance against Leinster last year was in the final was devastating. The vast majority of these guys play for England as well, so they've been winning a lot and performing very, very well. And you know, if they've breached it and cheated, they should be severely punished. And I agree with you, Nathan, the titles should be taken off them.
Given to Leinster was the point I was making.
Okay, okay, that's right.
Yeah. Good one.
What about your province, Connacht?
That's what I was going to ask. No, listen, and a day like this, and a day like this as well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
again,
exactly.
Turning his back on his own people. But that's
the fact
why
that I'm not from Connacht, of course.
The timing is interesting, is it? That, why wasn't this announced a month ago? Why wasn't this announced 2 months ago? Was it because they knew it would have a massively destabilising effect on the England squad?
It would have had a massive effect on the England squad, and they would have had to answer questions throughout the whole tournament about that. So that's the reason it didn't come out, which is fair enough, I think. Obviously, Premiership Rugby wanted England to do well, and but this is something that it's been an undercurrent, and people have been talking about it for a couple of years, and if it's wrong, and if they have cheated, which effectively it is, if you're breaching the salary cap, and they should be severely punished for that and reprimanded and have to make change there and adhere to that salary cap.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how it, like, obviously it's arose as a situation, so is it no longer a situation, or is that in itself going to have repercussions for that team? Are they going to have to essentially lose players or start paying them less money and ultimately lose them that way?
I'm not sure. It's definitely going to be divisive, and if players are on certain contracts for a number of years and
they've signed legally as well.
Yeah, and you see the simple nuts and bolts of this is if you've owned Farrell, the Vunipola brothers, Otoje, these guys, if they're trying to keep all the talent they have and keep a massive squad, and they're trying to stay under the 7 million or 7.5 million or whatever it is, and these guys are commanding salaries of 800,000 or whatever, that's probably too much, but you'd imagine that the top internationals are on 500,000 easily, 600,000, and if you add all the salaries up and they're over it, maybe they've taken out a number of individuals and said, look, we'll take X, we'll pay 150,000 into a company, or we'll invest in companies here for you, and you're not getting the cash, but you're getting the benefit of an investment. Yeah. And Nigel Ray was arguing that, you know, investments are different because they can go up, they can go down, and you can't judge the amount.
Yeah.
But look, everybody knows what they've done. He's trying to hoodwink people there now to say...
Look, we don't know if he's trying to explain it off in that way. None of us are financial experts, and like we'll have to see obviously how that plays out over the next couple of weeks and see what the explanation is and see the veracity of it. It's slightly lessened the bargaining chip of Kieran Marmion, I presume, over the last few days that I've got this offer over here. I mean, I don't know if that is now just suddenly and absolutely off the table or not, but... not the best bargaining chip for him to have now with his conversation with.
Yeah, but they'll still sign players. Saracens will still be a very strong side. They might have to do things differently and maybe release some of the top earners and bring in their academy system has been working incredibly well for them, in fairness to them. They've done a brilliant job there. So, you know, they're just going to have to balance the books and make sure they get under that salary cap, whether that affects him or not. I know Keith Earls only signed there a couple of years ago, and there was a very good offer on the table for
Saracens.
Him. Then he sat with Saracens, he re-signed with Munster. They've had a huge number. Elliot Daly has signed there, Liam Williams, a lot of outside overseas
players.
Jeez,
I can't imagine Keith Earls at Saracens. It's like the...
Well, it was two years ago. He nearly signed with him. It went right down to the wire with the RFU. But for Kieran Marmion, I think if there's an offer there, it may change things. Now, I don't know what they're going to do. So it's kind of speculation, but... I think Andy Friend spoke about, you know, how important he is to Connacht, and I think he's done a fantastic job over the last number of years, so it'd be a shame if they lost him overseas. But I think the fact that it depends how it plays out now with Andy Farrell in Ireland and where he is in the pecking order there, because obviously if you're not getting picked for Ireland here, well then you're going to be tempted by
And it's no harm for him, for his development, for his career, for a message to Andy Farrell that he's been linked with one of the top clubs in the world, obviously. The only doubt about, and looking at the playing roster, I mean, I'm not sure the answer to this one, but in terms of game time that he gets over there, like you look at the scrum half roster there at the minute, Alex Day, who's like a 26-year-old journeyman, essentially, Ben Spencer, the 27-year-old who people will be aware that squeezed into the England squad, he's got a handful of caps, got in there at the end of the Rugby World Cup. Tom Whitley's 23-year-old former fullback. And then obviously Richard Wigglesworth, who's like coming close to the end of his days, 30-odd England caps, whether or not Marmion starts or gets much game time.
You'd imagine he'd nearly go to the top of that pecking order. Himself and Ben Spencer would probably be the ones fighting out for that top position. But any of the top teams seem to have two, three players in every position who are top quality. And that's probably one of the reasons why they're breaching the salary cap, is because the depth in positions, the amount of players they have, and a lot of top earners, you know. So maybe they need to change the whole approach there and get kind of lower level players on lesser salaries and as their backup players. And, you know, but if for Kieran Marmion, like, his head will be turned by this offer if there is an offer on the table. And
do you think it's a gamesmanship or is there something in
I can understand. We've seen a lot of guys over the years who've used overseas offers to try and get better deals here. I think Connacht would definitely, because he's one of the top players for them, would definitely try and put their best foot forward. And I think it'll come down to ultimately where he kind of sits and what his mentality is around playing for Ireland.
Mm. Yeah, Andy Friend was saying obviously during the week that has indicated that he would like to stay, etc., etc., but seems to have been incredibly burnt by being left out of the World Cup squad. Bundyaki obviously is the other one who's in the middle of contract negotiations, and some indication that he too is kind of eager on a bit of a path out. Like, obviously, he was brought in, I don't think it was expressly at the time, but there was certainly an indication that at some point or another he was obviously going to qualify for Ireland, and at that point we'd get involved and away we go. Like, is there not almost some sort of a inbuilt inference that if that happens, like, you're going to stay here for your career? Like, is it not a bit of a slap in the face for Irish rugby if he decides that he's leaving?
You can't expect a player just to say, right, now, on one hand, there's been a lot of investment in him and he's been incredibly well looked after here and paid pretty well. His new contract was a significant increase on the original one he signed, the first one.
Yeah.
But you can't expect a player just out of loyalty to stay and not be able to move. Well, if you were a professional rugby player or a professional sports person, you'd understand, Adrian, it's cutthroat business. You know, if Bundyaki gets injured in the morning or he's gone, someone else comes in, it's just
But
the
it's
way
a different
it is.
Set of circumstances, because he's been brought in here expressly to come and play for Ireland.
And that's what I mean at the start. Of course, there's definitely a scenario where you feel that because Ireland have put him on the map, he's gone playing international rugby, he's earned significantly more money here. Mm. Not just his Connacht or his RFU contract, but he's got match fees for playing for Ireland fairly consistently in the last couple of seasons. But you can't expect someone to just go, well, I'm going to stay here now. If he gets, you've got to weigh up the option, and people realise it when they retire. You know, it's sport, it's business, people move on. It'd be incredibly disappointed. I'd be very disappointed if he did go. And I think he'd be a loss to Irish rugby, and it would be a little bit of a slap in the face to say, well, look, we've brought in a New Zealander here, he's become Irish qualified, and then after 5 years or whatever length of time, they decide they're gone and they're, you know.
Sport's full of slaps in the face.
It is, like, and you know, ultimately, Nathan, he'll go back home someday. You
but
know,
it doesn't make it right. Like, if CJ Standard did the same thing, we'd be saying, yeah, like, this is ridiculous. Like,
but there's hypocrisy
here, giving
in
you a
that.
Massive contract. You've taken a lot of caps off some
ways.
Irish
you use both ways, you know what I mean? It's sport, and that's it. And
like, the IRFU are cynical in bringing Bundyaki and CJ Stander in. Like, they're bringing them in with no connection whatsoever to Ireland to boost Irish rugby.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is that they're taking a punt on them. They're going out on a limb to bring this player in, obviously with the idea for the betterment of Irish rugby, for the betterment of the game, ideally that we start performing at World Cups, etc. So they are going out on a limb for them. And then if at some point after that they go,
but it doesn't matter. Your contract is your contract. you sign for X number of years, you renegotiate, you're happy with the offer or you're not, something else is on the table, you weigh it up, and I wouldn't hold it against anybody. I'd be disappointed because, but that's just the nature of it, and the IRFU will know that. Like, at some stage...
The IRFU, you know, didn't care less about the player CJ Sander was replacing or the player that Bundy Aki was replacing, whose career they were stalling.
Yeah, or vice versa. If they're replaced by someone else, you know, you could slip off the pecking order very, very quickly. And ultimately, both those guys will probably end up going back living in New Zealand and South Africa. I don't know. I'm speculating there, but I imagine they would. But if there's an offer comes on the table, and if CJ Stander, I'd be saying to my agent, well, see what's on the table and see what offers are there, and then you weigh it up and you make...
I think there's going to be a lot of pissed off Irish fans if that happens.
Yeah,
there
would, because there's a lot of Irish fans stuck up for him and kind of controversy around becoming nationalised and stuff like that. So, of course, yeah, a lot of people would be disappointed. But that's sport, Adrian, and whether you like it or not, it's it would be a slap in the face. But I would never hold it against a player having been there and done that. You know, Bundy Aki picks up an injury, runs in the next few months before he signs a new contract. You know, there might be nothing on the table for him. That's just the nature of the business. So if Connacht want to keep him, the RFU want to keep him, they've got to put their best foot forward and hope he makes a decision to continue playing international rugby, because obviously if he goes to France, the UK or Japan or back home, he's not going to be playing for Ireland anymore.
He didn't have as much to say when Robbie Henshaw was leaving Connacht, I can tell you.
What's the unique difference? The obvious difference. I know you're in Mayo generally sort of blinded to like the reality of a situation. He was staying
within
the IRFU. I mean, I understand that point, but there's it's different here because it is professional sport. I understand the point that Quinny is making. He would do the best for himself. But these guys have been brought in expressly with the intention to play for Ireland, and like, whether you like it or not, that's the reality of it. Oh. And then at some point after that, they're saying, do you know what?
That attitude you have is patronising bullshit towards Bundy Aki and CJ Stander, which is, ye lads, we plucked ye from obscurity, we gave ye a good life, and now ye owe us till the end of time.
That's literally what happened with CJ Stander.
He was talking about putting us in the front row
in South Africa. They didn't know what they didn't. He was looking.
So what? For the next 50 years, he must now live.
I'm
in
not
Limerick
saying that, but listen. But hang on a second. He's not like living like some pauper. Like, he's one of the best earning rugby players on the planet because he came here and was given a chance by the IRFU. Yeah,
but I think he's delivered enough. They've delivered. Bundy Aki's performed. You get paid to perform as a sports person. And like I said, it can change very, very quickly. And that's just the reality of modern sport. And for any top-class players, and you hear a lot of them talking now, when they retire, you're gone. That's it. You're gone.
Yeah, but it's not like he's living like a... my point is, it's not like he's on, like, threepence a week and he's struggling to make ends meet.
You think something should be put in at the end of their contract and say, please don't go at the end because...
No, but, like, there should be an inherent... understanding that, like, we have plucked you, in his case, from obscurity. He could have been lost to the game altogether.
You can't leave and go.
The opposite.
I mean, you can, and the evidence might be that they may do that. All I'm saying is, you do that and you slap Irish rugby supporters in the face as you do it.
But should that work the other way? So say CJ Stander hadn't worked out. When he came through, should the RFU have said, we're going to pay you 300 grand a year till you're 36, regardless of how good you are, because you're stuck here no matter what. So he needs to prove himself. But the IRFU don't need to...
It's not that he's proven himself. It's that there was a possibility with that one player that we're talking about could have been lost from the game entirely and was given a chance here to play professional rugby, to play international rugby, and has done bloody well out of it.
2v1 here. I don't think
Bundy Aki or CJ Stander should have been playing rugby for Ireland. But the decision was made to bring them in. You can't then hold them down and say you can never leave.
Lots of people would think that.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that, by the way. It's up to them to make the decision.
You're talking about loyalty.
Yeah.
Should there be more loyalty?
Loyalty. No, what did Roy Keane say? Loyalty.
Sorry, but there is no such thing as loyalty on both sides, as I'm saying.
Correct.
So CJ Stander has blocked somebody in Irish rugby's progress. Somebody at Munster's done everything right, come through the academy, and CJ Stander's been landed in at number 8, and they haven't got to play for Ireland because of that. Yeah. Where's the IRFU's loyalty to that person? It doesn't exist. Because the IRFU's job is to do the best
thing for Irish rugby. And the player's got to deliver and perform. And if they do that, they get paid the amount of money and stuff, you know. But your point is valid, and that there should be... you know, should it come into the thinking if Bondiaki's making this decision, well, all this stuff has been done for me and it's facilitated me. Of course it should be on his mind. But ultimately, if he's getting offered $600,000 contract from someone else and there's $300,000 on the table here, well, there's a gap there.
Look, I understand that.
So
understand
it depends.
That.
But, oh, look, you would hope it doesn't come down to that and that Marmion and Aki stay, because I think what's happened in Connacht and what Andy Friend has done, given where they were 2 years ago before he came in and the poor season they had under Kieran Keane, you need to build people around. The likes of Aki, Marmion, Carty, bring through more young players. So
isn't that the bigger issue here, actually, and one that will piss off Connacht fans yet again, is that I don't see any of the star players from Leinster, Munster or Ulster being tempted by big money offers abroad. So why are Kieran Marmion and Bundiaki?
That's not true.
No, but they ultimately always stay.
But should we think these two lads could end up?
Maybe they do.
I think they'll end up staying, unless they get an outlandish offer. But I would imagine, as I said, that Aki eventually will go back.
An investment account offshore somewhere. And
will eventually go back and live in New Zealand.
We'll do that in Connacht. The Marmion one is interesting. So Connacht play Leinster tonight, and like, you see a lot of the players are back involved already. It must, like, we heard Johnny Sexton during the week talking to Neil Tracy at the Champions Cup launch, and like, he was down. He couldn't hide the fact he was so down, and so many of these players must be trying to recover. And, like, Andy Friend has made that quite clear with Kieran Marmion not making the squad even. That does seem to be massively affecting his decision. He said, it's not as easy as turning off a tap and saying, that didn't happen, put on the Connacht jersey and off I go again. For Kieran, it was a really big blow, a really, really big blow. He missed out in the previous one as well. He's worked hard. He shared with us that he was frustrated. How difficult a job is it for Andy Friend, for Leo Cullen, to reinvigorate these guys when not only is it an important match tonight, but in a week's time they're playing Champions Cup rugby?
Yeah.
To not have Johnny Sexton in there, and they're professional, I get that. But like, if he's down, and for Leinster, 12 of the lads are a bit bloody depressed and coming back into camp.
Well, they've got to pick themselves up, Nathan, because at the end of the day, they're paid professionals. It's not easy, and I came back from World Cup in 07 with a different type of motivation, just wanting to play rugby again because I hadn't played it in France. I was one of four who didn't play. The other 26 were probably psychologically scarred from the disappointment and the negativity around the performances in France. Whereas I just wanted to go out and play again. My first game back was against Cardiff in Cork. I came off the bench for Munster. We were beaten 1917 or something. In normal circumstances, I'd be absolutely freaking and fighting with everyone if we lost the game and disgusted. But I remember going off the field saying, I'm back. That's the first step. I think we lost to the Ospreys 16-3 the week after away. Again, I was just glad I got out in the field and I was building. We beat Edinburgh then 19-16 the week after. And then we played Wasps in Europe and we lost in Coventry 24-23. And in the space of 4 weeks, I was involved in four games, and I was incredibly...
Like Rain Man here, by the way, with your memory of these scores from games 12 years ago.
No, but I was, because I've thought about that in the last week or two, because I'm going to do a piece on it anyway. So I was kind of, you know, I will go back. I'll have to Google and go back and go through these results. But I just remember that period was much easier for me as opposed to, you know, Marcus Horn, Gerry Flannery, John Hayes, Paul O'Connell, Dunica, Wally, Dennis Leamy, Stringer.
Is there anything a coach can do? Like, was that was within you, it sounds like, that you forced yourself?
When you go back to your province, you know what you need? You need some humour. You need to be slagged. You need a bit of a laugh about it. And I remember that happened with Munster. And I was joined in with the group that were slagging the Irish boys, saying, you were bloody useless, lads. What went wrong? You know what I mean? And so you need a little bit of humour around it. And you need to normalise it, because I think if nothing is said and you're expected to come back and just be a robot and just go back into the system, it can be difficult. The thing that the coaches have to manage and manoeuvre is who's right mentally or not. Just because a player is at a world, he's an international, and you expect him to just naturally switch on. Good coaching is, some guys will need a little bit of a poke to get him going, other guys will need an arm around him. So someone like Marmion needs an arm around him, probably with Andy Friend saying, look, you are brilliant, you've been brilliant for us, you should have been on the Irish squad, and tell him you're great. And then he believes that and he plays that way. The problem is if players start hitting a bit of stuttery form, it creates a little bit of self-doubt and a little bit of confidence. But the non-internationals are really important in those situations, where they're the ones that you and would have been a conscious decision with us, with me and Munster, that because I was probably torn between being in this Six Nations squad, sometimes going back, over and back a lot, where there was a core group of Munster lads who were with Ireland all the time. And one of the things I found, and we found as a group, was how important it was for the non-internationals to set the standard, if you know what I mean. Mm. That they don't expect internationals to come back, everything's going to be brilliant, now we're just going to go out and win on Saturday. Mm. Make it difficult for them to get back in the team, be angry if one of them is selected ahead of you, and, you know, create a little bit of an edge that they have to fight for their place back, in a sense. Mm. Ultimately, they're going to get picked unless something's drastically wrong with their performances. But it is difficult. You know, it will be difficult for those guys in the next few weeks.
A couple of quick comments to wrap on before we go. Message on Facebook asking if the RFU should be asking them to sign 6 or 8 year deals. Like, that'll just never happen, ultimately, for several reasons, I think, maybe on both sides. We'd probably agree that. The David Cordial was in touch, said they've played for Ireland, they've served us well. If they want to go somewhere else, I'll be disappointed, but I never hold that against them. And Hanoi Tripper says players got to make cash while they can, only one knee injury away from retirement. So, I mean, whatever.
The vast majority are agreeing with us, so
I'm glad that Adrian has committed his long-term future to off the ball, RTE, yeah, put the checkbook away.
It's a good job this lad isn't in too many Fridays, Quinny.
He's been great. No, I'm looking. Keep coming in, Nathan. Yeah, we'll put this fella back in his box.
Send Owen back to Mayo permanently and I'll come in here.
Quinny, thanks William for coming in. Nathan, fair play. You did more than enough parenting, so we were sort of doing you a favour is what happened there.
Yeah. Great to be here as always.
Thanks for coming in. That is it from us on OTB AM this morning, 9:35. Stay tuned, though, to the off-ball channels and to OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. If you've missed anything from OTB AM this morning, we had the sports pages a bit earlier. We spoke Liverpool City with Phil Thompson and Richard Dunn, rugby with Quinny there, and Owen Sheehan's day with Mayo GEA. Somebody, by the way, was in touch to say that Mick hasn't served a medium in Castlebar for years. So I think he just spotted
a special treat.
He spotted a candidate, let's call him. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcast. Also on the Go Loud app, you can watch it back on our YouTube channel as well and hit subscribe when you get that far. Tonight in Off the Ball, Friday Night Racing, Premier League preview, and it's all live from 7 o'clock and across the weekend. The Saturday panel tomorrow from 1 o'clock featuring
Motorsport.
2 o'clock to 5 football with
Dan and Johnny and Damien Delaney.
Oh, wow, good.
It's a good one, yeah. Sunday's going to be great.
Sunday. Paper review.
City.
Buzzing.
Paper review.
Paper review, yes, it's going to be great.
It's going to be great. It's United against Brighton with Stephen Doyle and...
It'll only be great if Liverpool win. If Liverpool win, it'll be great.
This is like a quiz. And 4:30...
But I don't have any answers.
Liverpool against Manchester City will be Stephen Kelly and Nathan Murphy. All right?
Yes.
Excellent.
Cannot wait.
Good morning.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.